Chicago Magazine editor and publisher Susanna Homan, comedian and filmmaker Bobcat Goldthwait, and another episode of The Frying Pan with local entrepreneur Steve Gadlin. And now, here's your host, a man who is single-handedly trying to bring back the pastel leisure suit, Justin Kaufman.
And not some newfangled leisure suit. We're talking fly collar. It's got to be fly collar. And you know, the problem with the leisure suits of today is they're probably hot, like if you go to the club, which I don't. But if you go to the club right now, like on a Friday or Saturday night, there's probably like some Billy Deck inspired cool leisure suit. That's like a $15,000 suit. No, I'm talking about that $85 joint from the thrift store. Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio 720, WGN. Very excited that you're with us tonight. Got a fun show for you here on this Good Friday. My guest tonight at the big table, the new editor and publisher of Chicago Magazine, Susanna Homan. Susanna came from Splash, and I can't wait to talk to her about her career in magazines, her thoughts on the future direction of Chicago Magazine, and the art and skill of covering celebrity here in the big city. Also coming up tonight, legendary comedian Bobcat Goldthwait. He's going to join us. He's doing a couple of shows in Aurora tonight and tomorrow at the Comedy Shrine. We'll talk about his films and the fact that One Crazy Summer turned 30 this year. Shakes the Clown, 25. What? Also, we'll get his thoughts on how to be happy in Hollywood. That's really where I'm thinking about this interview. How to be happy in Hollywood. Bobcat Goldthwait essentially quit Hollywood. So we'll talk to him about being fulfilled. And I'll ask him about Gary Shandling as well.
Tonight on The Download, Chicago Magazine editor and publisher Susanna Homan, comedian and filmmaker Bobcat Goldthwait, and another episode of The Frying Pan with local entrepreneur Steve Gadlin. And now, here's your host, a man who is single-handedly trying to bring back the pastel leisure suit, Justin Kaufman.
And not some newfangled leisure suit. We're talking fly collar. It's got to be fly collar. And you know, the problem with the leisure suits of today is they're probably hot, like if you go to the club, which I don't. But if you go to the club right now, like on a Friday or Saturday night, there's probably like some Billy Deck inspired cool leisure suit. That's like a $15,000 suit. No, I'm talking about that $85 joint from the thrift store.
Tonight on The Download, Chicago Magazine editor and publisher Susanna Homan, comedian and filmmaker Bobcat Goldthwait, and another episode of The Frying Pan with local entrepreneur Steve Gadlin. And now, here's your host, a man who is single-handedly trying to bring back the pastel leisure suit, Justin Kaufman.
And not some newfangled leisure suit. We're talking fly collar. It's got to be fly collar. And you know, the problem with the leisure suits of today is they're probably hot, like if you go to the club, which I don't. But if you go to the club right now, like on a Friday or Saturday night, there's probably like some Billy Deck inspired cool leisure suit. That's like a $15,000 suit. No, I'm talking about that $85 joint from the thrift store. Welcome to The Download, everybody. I'm Justin Kaufman here on WGN Radio 720, WGN. Very excited that you're with us tonight. Got a fun show for you here on this Good Friday. My guest tonight at the big table, the new editor and publisher of Chicago Magazine, Susanna Homan. Susanna came from Splash, and I can't wait to talk to her about her career in magazines, her thoughts on the future direction of Chicago Magazine, and the art and skill of covering celebrity here in the big city. Also coming up tonight, legendary comedian Bobcat Goldthwait. He's going to join us. He's doing a couple of shows in Aurora tonight and tomorrow at the Comedy Shrine. We'll talk about his films and the fact that One Crazy Summer turned 30 this year. Shakes the Clown, 25. What? Also, we'll get his thoughts on how to be happy in Hollywood. That's really where I'm thinking about this interview. How to be happy in Hollywood. Bobcat Goldthwait essentially quit Hollywood. So we'll talk to him about being fulfilled. And I'll ask him about Gary Shandling as well. Closer to home, Afrofuturism takes over at Second City. The new African-American sketch comedy show boldly takes the iconic comedy company to places they really haven't been before. We'll talk about the new show with comics Felonious Monk and Dwayne Perkins. Felonious and his return to the download. And the Sweet 16 is underway at the United Center. We'll catch up with the WGN Sports, I was going to say icon, but I guess it's kind of too early in Sam Penyanovich's career to call him an icon. We'll catch up with Sam, the legend. How about legend? Is legend work? Is legend okay? The legendary Sam Penyanovich about the games. We'll also get a baseball preview. We're 1 week away, a week or so, from opening day. Can you believe that? What's that mean for the squads in Chicago? Or better yet, are we done with the Adam LaRoche stuff? Yeah, we are? Awesome. Yes, let's get to it. And it's Friday, so that means it's also time for The Frying Pan, the best hour in Chicago radio. Steve Gadlin returns with a new idea to workshop. Will the Download Nation give him a thumbs up or a thumbs down? It's a holiday weekend, Pete. I think people are feeling generous. They're at home. Maybe they've already started their relaxation procedures. Maybe got a cocktail in hand. They're like, maybe I'll have two because it's Easter weekend. And maybe I'll like the inventions that are coming from Steve Gadlin. I'm feeling positive, feeling optimistic here on The Download tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier, and also production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and tonight, it's The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, well, let's kick it off. You want to do the carryout? Let's do the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the newspaper so you don't have to. Here are today's top stories. Hey, it's Good Friday, which is the day Jesus died, not the day that Kanye West puts out new music on SoundCloud, just for future reference. Senator Kirk said he's going to meet with Judge Merrick Garland, President Obama's choice for the Supreme Court. He breaks rank with Senate Republican leadership, which probably doesn't hurt him right now, if you think about it. Is Kirk trying to distance himself from the party establishment? I don't know. Maybe tell all these politicians in Washington that they're doing it wrong. Maybe he can make America great again. I smell it. It's a Trump VP campaign. Huh? Trump Kirk? No? Anybody? In national news, presidential hopeful Ted Cruz is denouncing the Inquirer story about his five affairs, saying it's garbage put out by the Trump campaign. He now calls him Sleazy Donald, while Trump continues to call Ted Cruz Lion Ted. I'm sorry, when did we start naming presidential candidates like blues musicians? Dun, 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 dun. His name is Sleazy Donald. Dun, 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 dun. And he gonna raise your taxes. Dun, 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 dun. A new study says that Chicago has too much parking. That's right, too much parking. Thanks to apartment buildings and the huge parking structures attached. So could we pave the parking lot and put up a paradise? Huh? Little reverse Joni Mitchell for you there? Am I blowing your mind tonight? Am I? Authorities say there's not only lead in the water supply, but they're saying there's lead in our chocolate. What? Scientists are saying that there's lead, but not enough to harm us. But what if you ate like 35 Cadbury eggs today? I'm just asking for a friend. Metal detectors will greet fans at Wrigley Field this season. This is the new safety precautions put in place by Major League Baseball. Good. Does this mean that the old-timey banjo band can't come in the park anymore? How about Ronnie Woo Woo? Have you seen his molars lately? All metal. Now, they'd only do breathalyzers. In weather, nice brisk day downtown. So many tourists on Michigan Avenue flipping off the Trump building for their Instagram feed. In sports, the Bulls cooked. Losing back-to-back games to the New York Knicks. Totally brutal. What's it mean? Well, it means that the Bulls logo is going to be branded on a couple ping pong balls this summer for the NBA lottery.
Wow, it's pretty hard to miss the NBA playoffs. I mean, 8 teams in the NBA East make the playoffs. Let me name a couple. The Charlotte Hornets, the Atlanta Hawks, the St. Croix Johnsons. That's not even a team, and they made the playoffs. I hope something happens here because Fred Hoiberg, D. Rose, Jimmy Butler, you got to essentially win out to make it. This is ridiculous. We're talking about the 8th seed here. What happened? Did you see Will Perdue say on Comcast Bulls postgame that Michael and Scotty were overrated defensively? He went on to say that they knew that they had guys like Will Perdue behind them. You mean like behind them in a suit on the bench getting a big fat DNP next to their stat line? Because that was pretty much half the year. Yeah, I remember that. I remember the Utah Jazz in the finals where Michael and Scotty were mic'd up and they're like, oh, I think I'm just going to be lackadaisical because Will Perdue's right back here. Come on, man. Give it a rest. The Sweet 16 comes to Chicago tonight. That's why you see so many Iowa State sweatshirts all around town. That or there's a significant push to get Fred Hoiberg back to Iowa, which is okay. Jake Arrieta has a blister. Oh, there it is. Season over. I knew it. Let's get Kyle Loesch on the phone. We need another starting pitcher. Oh, what? It's okay. It's healing. He's going to be fine. Whew. Oh, and Kyle's on the phone. Oh, hey, Kyle. Hey, no, I was just seeing how you're doing. I'll call back later. That's tough. Oh, no, Josh Hill, the tight end that the Bears went after, had his contract offer matched, and he's going to stay in New Orleans. Nothing like fighting for a third-string tight end, Josh Hill, during the Easter weekend. The Hawks are in Calgary tomorrow. Got to start a winning streak there. I think it's appropriate. You start with the Canadian teams. I've heard they're bad at hockey. And finally, Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice is out to mixed reviews. The Trinity of Heroes forms one half of the Justice League and one whole justification for the movie's pretentious subtitle. If you don't know, the Justice League is DC Comics' equivalent of the Avengers in every way except the box office. That's the carryout for this Good Friday, March 25th, 2016. Hey, do you like colored eggs? We got plenty. Not because of Easter, just because they're like 2 weeks old. They turn.
More to come tonight on The Download. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Susanna Holman, Chicago Magazine editor and publisher, will be in studio at the big table. Also coming up, cast Afrofuturism at Second City. And later, Bobcat Goldthwait. It's The Download tonight here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Sounds like a stripped down version of "Welcome to My House." Da, 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 like you can see on the Pizza Hut commercials. It does, doesn't it? It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman, with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Honored to be here on Good Friday, and excited. And thank you very much for listening and being a part of the program tonight. The Frying Pan coming up at 10 o'clock. We're gonna yay or nay on Steve Gadlin's latest invention. I'm excited. He hasn't been here for the last 2 weeks because we've been off. He was actually out in Europe. He was doing some stuff in Europe. So he's back. So It's exciting to have him back on the program. I missed it.
Oh, it's my favorite part of Friday broadcast.
You're just about to say life.
It's up there, but I don't want to seem like
I can't even remember the last thing he did, and he really was discouraged because the Download Nation was just like Nay City.
That's why he went to Europe, right? To find inspiration.
That's right. He went to Tibet. It was a Europe by way of Tibet. Because he was like, I need to cleanse. He did a cleanse. Or maybe he just did that in his bathroom. I don't know. You could do that at home now, I guess. What are you doing? You got big Easter plans?
Nah. I'm not a big Easter guy. No. I mean, I'm Catholic. I went to Catholic school all my life. And I always hated Good Friday because, like, my mom would make me stay in from, like, 12 to we would have the day off. And then my mom would make me stay in from, like, 12 to 3 because, you know, that's when Jesus was on the cross. You have stay in your room.
Well, what did she at all explain time zones? Because you're talking about probably 6 or 8 hours up. right?
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, it was not
it should have been. She should have got you up at like 6 in the morning, right?
It would have been better. But you just had to sit there and, you know, like not, you couldn't do it. You couldn't like play video games, couldn't do read. You just had to sit and contemplate what, you know, Jesus has given to you.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what was the time? Like, was this, like, from toddler? Like, was
yeah,
this
like,
a thing that you did
until
you were,
finally,
like, a
teenager? And then finally, like, in, like, maybe 7th or 8th grade, I rebelled.
You pushed back,
and,
you pushed back.
Yeah.
Stuck out the window.
Like, she went to work, and I took off.
Snuck out the window, got your BMX bike.
Exactly.
Took
yeah.
off.
Yep.
There you go.
Rode up to McDonald's.
I just keep thinking of the scene in Baskets with Louis Anderson. They go to Easter brunch, and they go to the casino. And then that whole thing with Martha's parents, that was really funny. Yeah, I don't do too much with Easter. I mean, Easter is always a fun thing. It's a family thing, so it's always good. And Easter egg hunts and things. When my son was younger, they would do Easter egg hunts in the parks here in Chicago. Like, you go up to the one in Bucktown or any park district, essentially, like put on by friends of that park.
Yeah, yeah.
But I always had a problem with it because it wasn't a traditional Easter egg hunt where you would, like, hide it.
They were just out?
They just said, go, and a bunch of, like, three-year-olds, like, blah, 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 and they're like, pick up the plastic egg. Pick up the plastic egg.
So they're not hidden. They're just out in
no,
the grass.
No, they're just out, and then just everyone grabs it. And yeah. then there'd be one kid who, like, had kind of was a little bit older and had figured out that there was stuff inside, so then he would just try to clean it up while your two-year-old was trying to figure out how to pick up.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's unfair.
Yeah, they destroy the concept. I get the concept, like it's a family thing and your kid, but it wasn't hidden. It was just like they would just litter the park with plastic eggs.
Yeah,
and then you would show up for an hour when it's cold, and get the rewards, which was usually like three jelly beans or like a little fun sized Three Musketeers.
When you're two or three, do you understand the concept of finding things that are hidden?
Oh, I thought you were going to say the concept of Easter, Jesus.
No.
It's funny because I had to talk to my son about it. I'm like, well, he's like, what's Good Friday? I'm like, well, that's when Jesus died. And I'm like, and then on Sunday and Easter, that's when he rose again. Or that's when he okay, go to, you know what, you play on the iPad. Essentially enough. Yeah, you can play Minecraft. I don't care. I'm trying here. I don't know.
That was very good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I did, not unlike your mom, I spent a little bit of time, you know, on Good Friday. You had to spend a couple hours contemplating. Mm-hmm. He had 30 seconds. Strong. All right. Rob Martier is here. Rob, you paying attention to the NCAA tournament here in Chicago?
I know.
How about that?
I know. A couple of big games today.
I know. How about some winning basketball in Chicago for a change?
Well, hey, look, we've got DePaul women, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's tomorrow.
Right. We've got DePaul women.
I didn't even mention that in the carryout. That, I mean, we had Doug Bruno and Coach Bruno on earlier this week.
Yeah, Pequots.
They got a big game tomorrow. Oregon State is not a pushover. They're the number two seed. I'm worried. But if they get that win, they're going to have to take on Baylor. And I talked to Coach Bruno about this. The only thing I know about women's college basketball is Connecticut, Stanford, the Lady Volunteers,
yeah,
and Baylor, because they have the crazy neon jerseys.
Well, and Gino Auriemma with UConn has just been dominant for how long now?
I mean, it's amazing. They don't even lose games. I mean, they've changed the course of women's college basketball, that squad.
Yeah.
And they're on the other side, so I think they wouldn't see them till a championship if they got through.
Well, and then, you know, Pat Summitt down at Tennessee before she, mm-hmm. you know, fell ill. She had a huge, powerful program down there with the women.
Listen to you. You got it all figured out.
Hey, look, man, I covered it in college, and I've got a daughter who loves basketball.
Awesome.
So
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I wish they did. I actually would love it if they did regionals of the NCAA women's here. Because I would go see that. The Sweet 16, I don't want to see Virginia. I don't care.
Yeah. It's a good draw.
It is, yeah. It's the number one seed here, so. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, a new show is up at Second City Wednesday nights at the Second City ETC. It's called Afrofuturism, and it's a blend of sketch comedy, stand-up, performance, and music from a black perspective. something we haven't seen much from the venerable Northside Comedy Institution. Sure, there have been shows, you know, before, but this seems to be something more. Dare I say a movement? You know?
I dare you to say it.
Joining me, two members of the cast, Felonious Monk and Dwayne Perkins. Felonious Monk can be seen all over Chicago performing stand-up. We've had him on the program before. And Dwayne Perkins is part of the Second City Touring Company, and he's part of the show as well. Both of you, thanks for being here tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. So let's talk
about the show. I mean, this was actually a little bit, it wasn't a show that you guys brought to Second City. It's a show that kind of came out organically through a showcase.
Right. We did a showcase back in the BET showcase back in December. The show went really well. We thought we were going to have a very small audience, just a focus group. And we ended up having a lot of people in the audience. And Billy Bungaroth, one of the directors there, had worked with Dave Hellam and I, who were here before, with our Blipster Life show. And we thought that there was a way to blend those things together and add in the Second City cast. And so we got some amazing people like Dwayne and Shantira Jackson and Sonia Denis and Torian Miller. We've added a number of people from Second City who have just added a flavor to what Dave and I were already doing. So it's a blend of what we were doing with what Second City
does. Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, a Second City traditional show, I mean, a touring company show, is going to be more of the sketch comedy, lights up, lights down, put the piano. How is Afrofuturism different?
So I host it, which...
That's different.
That's different. So there's a host element where we come out and we explain the theme of that show for that night. It's very topical. It changes week to week. And we blend stand-up in between, and sometimes we not only blend stand-up in between the sets, but we blend stand-up and sketch in one performance. So Dave has some bits that he does that lend themselves to act-outs, and then you get someone like Dwayne, who's fantastic, hard to stop watching on stage, and he helps to act out these jokes. It turns it into something completely different than we'd ever been able to do with just stand-up or just sketch.
Dwayne, what's the difference between doing this show and doing sort of a traditional Second City fair?
Well, a traditional Second City show, like a Torco show, is a mix of archive scenes from the Second City's history, from their stages, and then improvisation. Whereas this show is, like, we change it weekly based off, like, what's happening, based on social issues, and we collab and we write scenes and sketches based off what
So you guys are doing that weekly?
Yeah.
Wow, that's great.
And then there's a lot of... opportunity to bring our own stuff in. Like, I've done a couple solo pieces that speaks to the theme of that week. Mm-hmm. So it's a show like Second City has never seen, because it does take so much more of what we bring, and we create the show from the people rather than just people doing a show.
Well, I want to read what you guys have in the sort of description. I like this. The vanguard of Chicago's hippest African-American talent delivered the street satire and cultural cosmologies of a city on the brink. Talk about the city on the brink. I mean, that's the part where you said, I mean, I mean, everything about that plays to you guys are doing a real sort of, you know, socially conscious kind of comedy.
I think Chicago is in a unique place. It could easily go the direction of Detroit right now. We've got some problems with pensions and some school closings. But on the other side of that, you have like this creative talent here. And again, just taking Second City and taking some of the talent that's left recently with the Little Rel Howery and Hannibal Buress and Langston Kerman, who just wrote part of the monologue for Chris Rock for the last Oscars, like names that we don't hear about, but they're doing amazing things out of the city. All of those guys came from Chicago. And then you have Second City with their history. And then you have guys like me and Dave. You know, I'm doing the nightly show, and Dave's doing accidental comedy this year, and he just did oddball comedy last year. Like, these are names that are doing things in the industry. And that's kind of the movement. We're going in that direction away from some of the trouble, and we get to speak on the trouble. There are bits about police brutality. There are bits about politics. There are also bits just about social issues and Kanye West and Kim Kardashian. So the idea of the city,
it is a comedy club.
It is a comedy club. But, you know, there are bits that address things that are very unique to the city. But they're also, I think, Chicago kind of identifies with the rest of the country, because we've got this interesting election right now with, you know, Trump being a little more outwardly xenophobic than we've ever seen a candidate before. And then you have the old guard with the Hillarys and, you know, those people. So we talk about it all.
Yeah. And I think growing up in the city, I didn't know what Second City was until my freshman year of college. My dorm went to a free trip there, and I was like, what is this? Why have I never known about this? And I was like, oh, because I live on the south side. And there's a clear separation between the city.
Right.
And I think that there is an opportunity to speak upon that, which, because Second City is sometimes mostly predominantly white at times, the perspective of what Chicago is isn't the full spectrum. So it gives the opportunity for someone like me who would see a show and be like, well, that's not the Chicago that I know.
Right.
To then let people know the Chicago that I know. Like, this is where I grew up. It's not always like, oh, Cubs. It's like, oh, the first, I hate the Cubs. I think Wrigleyville is the worst place in Chicago. I said it.
That was Dwayne Perkins. That was not Filonis.
Wrigleyville is the devil.
That's okay.
And it's the opportunity to, like, for people like me to speak and for people that grew up like me to see somebody who lives in the Chicago that they live in. Because sometimes most people think Chicago stops at 35th. You're like, I'm going to take the red line to the Sox Stadium.
No, that's a great point, because I know just from the history of Second City in the last couple decades, I mean, they've been trying. There was talk of a Second City in Bronzeville. There was a talk. There's been outreach programs. A lot of my friends have been involved in those programs. But there's been this effort to diversify because they recognize that that is a pretty white cast of people that are coming through. But the audience as well. I mean, it's a tourist audience that's coming from, and they draw really great crowds and people come in. But it's known that, you know, audiences not only from Chicago, but people coming in from Wisconsin and Iowa and other places for a night. How is it performing to those kind of audiences and challenging them?
So, I think that's what makes this show pretty special, is because, like you said earlier, there were like some like outreach shows and stuff like that. But this show kind of normalizes blackness, so it makes it like accessible to white people. It's not like we're like, hey, this is a black show for black people. We're like, hey, this is a show where we might talk about black things and we might not. It's because we're all black. Like, we know we're black. We don't have to yell at each other that we're black. So
I'm black, Dwayne.
Gonna get a bunch of black people being like, black, 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 we're black. Like,
blackety, black,
we're gonna
black.
Talk about
don't
things.
Give away your material, guys.
Black, black, blackety, black.
We're just gonna talk about things with a black perspective, so you would see us as just people who so happen to be black, and not like, oh, look at the black show.
Well, that's a very I think you used the word normalize, and that I think that's the biggest part, because there's this idea that South Side looks one way and West Side looks one way and black looks one way. And then you come to the show and you see a bunch of different looks and sounds and styles. And, you know, Sonya Denis is not Shantira Jackson, is not Asia Bullock, is not Ron Kate. Like, they're different women who have voices. They're different men who have voices. They're different perspectives. Dave's perspective isn't my perspective. I might do a joke about being old and someone else does a joke about hating old people. And then you start to go, wait, if I took away black from this show, it's the same show I would see with just black people happening to be in it.
You know, that far too often when there's a show that may be, yeah, this is a black comedy show, there's going to be a huge emphasis on race.
Right.
Right. And you're making, you know, jokes to those stereotypes or you know, and the way of just even the setup. So the idea here is to show that, you know, it doesn't really matter necessarily, you know, that this is a black show. Mm-hmm. It's a funny show.
Right.
And it's also representing a part of Chicago that maybe people aren't that familiar with.
And we don't shy away from, you know, I don't want to give the impression that we never address race.
No.
But, it's, you know, it's the elephant in the room. When I walk out on stage, the show's called Afrofuturism. There's a Fred Hampton clip playing behind me. And you look up at the cast that just danced around and you go, oh, this is really a black show. But also, we're going to talk about things that maybe we only talk about in the living room, or things that maybe we only talk about in the barbershop, and other audiences aren't privy to that conversation. They don't know what our relationship is with religion, for example, or why do we seemingly only vote for Democrats? And then there's an answer in the show. And why are LGBT issues seemingly something that we stay away from? And we don't stay away from them in this show. We address things directly. So it's a very in-your-face way of, we don't do anything subtle. It's very much taking a sledgehammer to the ant, and you leave knowing what we intended for you to do.
Why do this show at Second City? Why not do this show, you know, on the South Side at a different club? Why do it in Old Town at the Second City?
This may sound very militant, but my question is like, why not? Like, that's where it needs to be done. Why would I go to a group of black people to tell them what it's like to be black? They know. Like, I want.
So this is a show for the Second City audience.
Yeah, this is a show to let people know that. Because for me personally, being often the only person of color within a cast, my voice then becomes representative of my race. And this is a show that lets you know we're not all the same. We're, our voices are very different. We don't agree on the same thing. And
I agree with
the
you.
The people that need to see that are the people that believe that that is that black people do have one singular voice.
Right.
And so I think those are the exact people to do it to. So then when they come see shows, they will start to expect what we're giving instead of being like, oh, that one person should represent this one thing.
It also helps. I would say it helps you and your performances as well when you're not necessarily in an all-black cast and you're, like you just mentioned, you're the one representative, that you don't have to be representative
being
of
the
all
only,
racial issues.
Being learning. The only one in the room is a lot tougher than... And so, but the other part I think that's amazing, and this is kudos to Second City for this, for being willing to put the show on. They've put their arm behind it. They've put the money behind it. They've put their money where their mouth is. There's the marketing is there. They put on a quality show. We don't get secondhand anything. The music is right. The sound is right. The lighting is right. The direction is right. We're writing together. They make space for us to do these things. So the question isn't just why Second City. It's really why not? This is the best place to do this type of show. They have the best reputation for putting this type of show together. Yeah. And the fact that it happens to be a quote unquote black show just goes to show that they're willing to do a little bit more. This, we appreciate having
I think
that support.
I think back to some of the interviews I've heard or people who've written books about Second City, about the late 60s being a place where you really felt in Old Town that the police were going to knock down the door.
Right.
Because of the comedy that was on that stage. Yeah. That was a real vibe that was coming out of Old Town.
That's what we're hoping now. Yeah.
So, I mean, the same, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense to have a show that, that is in that same vein or that same sort of feel that's happening in the same building.
It's an edgy show for multiple reasons. One, it's edgy because the quality of the writing is fantastic. I don't think I've ever been in a cast of people, even on stage, and sorry to my stand-up friends, I've done some great shows, but I've never been around this many talented people at one time. But the second thing is, because we're all pushing each other, it's like having a freestyle battle with Jay-Z and Biggie and DMX and Tupac, and they're all on the same track trying to outdo each other. Every week, someone is going, oh, okay, you're going to talk about that? Mm-hmm. Well, watch this. Then I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to take it one step further.
I got a couple minutes left, and mm-hmm. I just want to ask about the collaboration, because obviously the stress of being able to put new material on once a week means communication has to be tight. You all have to have trust in each other as a cast. There's not a lot of room for error when you're doing that kind of stuff. So talk about that process for you both. You know, you've at Second City Touring Company have a little bit more collaborative experience, but Felonious, I mean, you're stand-up. I mean, there's not, I know this.
I don't accept
doing
tags
before.
From anybody. Don't write me in saying that joke should be written this way. I kill everybody.
How do you do it? I mean, how do you make sure that everybody is on the same page and working towards a goal of getting the material on stage in such a quick fashion?
Trust in talent. I feel like because there is such a high level of talent, there's no doubt that if I give something to someone that it won't be good. I know that I have certain talents in writing, certain in this section, but I know that someone else is really good at joke telling. So if I'm like, hey, I need a joke for this one part, I'm not going to be like, what's the joke? I'm going to be like, just do it.
Just punch
I trust
it
you.
Do
and
it.
That's the whole vibe of the entire show. There's been times right before shows where somebody like can't make it and Billy's like, hey, do you got a solo piece? I'm like, sure. And he's like, don't care what it is. I trust you. You're great.
That's
do
great.
It.
And every week, the thing is when you're flying by the seat of your pants, sometimes like we are, where there's a last minute, Dwayne, can you add that piece in, make it five, do it now by yourself? And you're like, yeah, I'm ready. But the thing is, watching it backstage when you don't know what's going to happen every
That's
week
great.
And then at the end of the show going, oh my gosh, every one of you killed it again tonight. This is 12 weeks in a row where we've all killed it. This congratulations. They have our backs. They each one. That's a performance thing where right before the show,
right,
everyone says, I have your back.
Each other's back and say, we got your back.
Got your back.
And at the end of the night, you know they had your back.
Felonious
like
Monk
that.
And Dwayne Perkins are both part of the show Afrofuturism, which is playing Wednesday night at the Second City ETC. How long's the run?
We're going to run it until people stop coming.
Yeah.
So right
well, we
now
gotta come out. We got to when
WGN is all in the whole everyone. You're all invited.
I want to come next time we have a show off when there's a Hawks game. I got to come out and see it.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being in, guys. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
You know, we should totally have a field trip to see Afrofuturism. I'd go say I agree with Dwayne was saying that so many times in Second City and improv in general, if there's any diversity, it's one member, maybe two members of the cast. They have a lot of problem with white dudes, right? So a white dude problem in Chicago comedy. So to have a show that is exclusively African American show, and for them to take on the idea of not just what's happening in the city socially and politically, but also to be able to do that every week, it's pretty impressive. It's getting good reviews. It's a good show. I'd recommend it, but we'll have to wait until we have a Blackhawks. I don't think there are any Wednesday games left in the season.
Yeah, maybe
in
the playoffs.
But then we'll be at a bar watching the game. That's going to be tough. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. Maybe we just call them and say, can you do Thursday instead? All right, coming up here, Susanna Homan, the new editor and publisher of the Chicago Magazine, is going to be with us. She's my guest tonight at the big table. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Well, earlier this month, a change was made at the top of Chicago Magazine. New Tribune owner Michael Farrell replaced editor Beth Fenner with Splash editor-in-chief and publisher Susanna Homan. Homan's no stranger to magazine production. She built Michigan Avenue Magazine from the ground up, and she successfully runs Splash, the Sun-Times-owned magazine that focuses on style and culture. And Homan knows newspapers, too. She was the woman behind Susanna's Night Out, the popular nightlife column that ran in the Sun-Times from 2001 to 2008. That's over 15 years of Chicago media, not including her time at Northwestern, graduating from the Medill School of Journalism. And it's my pleasure to welcome Susanna Homan to the big table tonight. Susanna, thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks.
Good to
see
you.
Great to be here.
So why take this job? I mean, this is a big job. Why move from Splash to Chicago Magazine?
Well, it's interesting because it wasn't something that I was gunning for or that 3 weeks ago I even knew was going to happen. It happened pretty suddenly. And it's a sort of opportunity that when you get the phone call and somebody says, you're getting traded to the majors, you take it. You have to.
Right.
But it was definitely a surreal time because I had about a day's notice before the rest of the world did. And, I had to leave my Splash team, and I right. love them. They're my family. And then on Monday morning, 2 weeks ago, I had to meet a whole new team, and I didn't know any of them. So
that's got to be so stressful. I mean, obviously the idea of moving on is great for your career. And like you said, you have to go when the opportunity is there. But to be able to tell a team that trusts you and to move to a team that doesn't know you, I mean, there's a lot of stress involved this month.
It's a little weird, I'll be honest. And, and they're all the most incredibly talented and capable people. And I was aware walking in that they'd be looking at me and thinking, well, does she want to change everything? And, I have a lot of empathy for people going through transitions like that. So it was very hard for me to walk in. I wanted to make sure everybody felt okay. And it's been a couple of very tentative weeks and spending time getting to know people and, learning about their lives. They have kids, they have dogs, they have homes. And because I think it's really important to know them as people and what their interests are. So,
well, you're no stranger to transition. I mean, you've moved from place to.
For
I mean,
sure. but not by design is the weird thing. I mean, I've had one of those careers. I grew up in a working class immigrant household, and by the time I was 25 years old, I'd kind of surpassed every expectation I had for myself, which is not saying much. I didn't really have big expectations for my life at all. So every time something like this happens, it's kind of. For me, like, okay, let's do it.
Well, I'm interested. I want to talk because we got you for the whole hour, and we're going to talk about magazines because what you did at Michigan Avenue Magazine, you pretty much built it from the ground up. But you were recruited from Michigan Avenue Magazine to run Splash by Michael Farrell.
That's right.
And then again recruited out of Splash to come work at Chicago Magazine. Talk about that because it seems like Michael Farrell has pinpointed you to be the magazine person in Chicago.
You know, I think it's how everybody who owns or runs a company is. They have these trusted deputies. And if you look at the people he's brought in any organization that he's had, you see a lot of that. And I think that's something you see kind of in any sort of situation. People bring the people they trust in. But I first met Michael probably, 10 or 12 years ago. It was a long time ago. And when I was at Michigan Avenue, I encountered him several times based on stories that I was working on. And I also knew him through the Economic Club, which is kind of a business nerd.
Yeah, he was a tech guy, right? He was running tech and stuff.
So
like
I would
that.
Go to these events, and I would see him. I would see his wife. And what happens is when he bought the Sun-Times, he said, oh, I know the right person to launch a magazine because she already runs a magazine and already launched one. So so I spent 4 years building Splash. And, you know, it's not easy to do. You're going against industry trends and market forces when you're launching two magazines post 2008.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of people trying to get, and I want to talk, after the break, I want to ask you about that because, yeah, a lot of people are getting out of magazines.
Yeah,
and
right.
You seem to be doubling down on magazines.
I seem to be. I hope it's a good
but,
idea.
You know, I mean, it is interesting because you've seen a little blowback to Michael Farrow owning the Tribune and the Sun-Times, all the kind of stuff that happened. And your move to the Chicago Magazine made headlines and everything, and media
sure
was
did,
stirring around.
I'll tell you what, I decided 2 weeks ago when this all blew up, I started reading the coverage and I thought, you know, do I really want to look at the comments? Do I want to know? I've seen enough comments about me when I've changed jobs in the past.
Right.
They're not pretty.
You should host an AM radio show at night and see what people say.
You don't want to know what people say about you. So I decided to just kind of let it be. And I got plenty of text messages from people saying, wow, people really hate you. Or, you know, you should see the mean things people are saying. And I thought, you know, I really shouldn't read any of this because I don't want it in my head. I want to be able to go and create and do it freely without really worrying about what people are saying.
Well, there's been a lot of media out there, even, you know, from the Chicago Reader or other places that have said, you know, they don't like the move because they think that they think highly of Chicago Magazine, and they think that what's going to happen is that it's going to be the new Splash. That you're going to take Splash and make it Chicago Magazine.
Well, what's interesting about that is Splash was a very specific mandate that I was given. The Sun-Times is a universe, and there is a news section and a sports section, and there are all sorts of writers and editors doing what they're good at. And so when I was brought in, I was specifically asked to do a style section, and that's what I did. And it was meant to appeal to a type of reader that wasn't being addressed. We know people's attention spans are very short. My attention span is about 4 seconds long now. You know, because you're sitting there, you're watching TV, and you're on your iPhone, and you know, you're texting people, and you're checking your email every 8 minutes. And so Splash was developed with kind of the modern reader in mind. You know, 15-minute read, easy to get through, tons of pretty pictures, fun writing, up to the minute. High frequency. So it was created to address a very specific need in the market because there were already plenty of monthly magazines. And when I was at Michigan Avenue, I had a very specific mandate. It was meant to appeal to those 1%ers, the luxury lifestyle, of which I'm really not familiar. But, you know, there are readers who want that sort of publication. So I think it's funny when people criticize what I've done and they put me in a box. I mean, I guess that's what people do. But it says more about them than about me.
Well, I mean, what do you see Chicago Magazine being? I mean, what is Chicago Magazine to you? Is it a service magazine? Is it a trade? Like, what is Chicago Magazine?
I mean, it's everything, just like the city. So, you know, they've done a lot of really incredible stories about crime, and a crime is a part of life if you live in Chicago. But they also do service pieces, and for people not in the industry, that means, you know, they taste 200 pizzas and rank the 30 best. And that's important to Chicagoans too, and personality profiles, the fascinating people who make our city tick. I mean, these are all elements, and I think that a successful magazine weaves together all of these notes so that as you read it, you see something gritty, you see something beautiful, you see something informational, and it delivers an entire experience. And it hits all those different notes.
You know, as we mentioned, I mean, you've been recruited and you've sort of been a deputy to Michael Farrow. What does the public or the media or the critics, what do they not understand about Michael Farrow?
Well, I mean, I definitely have a perspective, and I don't know if mine is right. But I guess one thing I would say is, you know, people criticize him for swooping in and spending all this money and making all these dramatic changes. But if I were worth hundreds of millions of dollars, I would be on a yacht somewhere. I probably wouldn't be spending it trying to save an industry. So I think that he should get more respect as being somebody who is taking this great wealth. And not a lot of people. So a few years ago when he bought the Sun-Times, the Sun-Times was, you know, within weeks of going under.
Right.
entirely and no money in the bank and no ability to pay the bills, and hundreds of people would have lost their jobs. So he stepped in, and, you know, this is money that he could be passing on to his children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and instead he was trying to save a newspaper. And of all the investors, he put in the most money, the biggest chunk. And again, you know, he's the one who's doubling down now on the Tribune. And so I have a lot of respect for the fact that he's unafraid to enter an industry that the world says is dying and invest heavily in it and save jobs and try to innovate. And, you know, it's not easy to innovate in this industry because there are a lot of people who've been doing what they're doing for decades. So you are trying to turn around a ship. And it's exciting to be on the front lines as this is happening.
Susanna Homan's the new editor and publisher at Chicago Magazine. We'll take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about magazine production because we've mentioned it a couple times now. People are just sort of like, let's not do magazines. And you're like, I'm in. So we'll talk more with Susanna here on The
good.
Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's The Big Table. My guest, Susanna Homan, who's the editor and publisher of Chicago Magazine. Double title.
Right?
There's a little bit of criticism on that, too, because, you know, that's usually two jobs.
It is.
Why are you both?
You know, it's interesting. When I started with the Sun-Times and Splash 4 years ago, they handed me the editor and publisher title in that role, but it got a lot less attention, apparently.
Right.
And Jim Kirk is the editor and publisher of the Sun-Times, the newspaper. And, you know, at the time, 4 years ago, I wasn't sure that it made sense. And the more time I spent in the role, the more it became apparent that it makes sense, because there are a lot of business decisions that you have to weigh.
Right.
So, for instance, you know, if you are at Chicago Magazine, a big chunk of the circulation is newsstand sales. So if you are making a decision of what to put on the cover, as we were making today, you have to weigh your editorial interest with what's going to sell on the newsstands, because it's the bottom line issue.
But wasn't that always the idea of an editor and publisher being separate, because then you would you almost have a firewall where one has an idea and the other one bounces the other idea off, and you kind of protect yourself in the way that, you know, you don't make bad choices.
Yeah, you know, hopefully I won't be making bad choices. You're gonna have to tell me in a few months. But it's not so much that you're saying, okay, we're gonna do an 8-page story on this advertiser. That's not gonna happen. But it's more that you're just aware of the metrics and all the things that feed into creating a successful publication.
You know, we mentioned this and we teased it out before the break about magazine production, because you were a columnist. What got you interested in magazines, especially Michigan Avenue Magazine, which is what you is sort of your baby?
I know this may sound ridiculous, but I never had any intention of going into magazines. I was happy doing Susanna's Night Out, and I was approached by the company that was launching Michigan Avenue in Chicago. It's a company based in New York that does city magazines all over the country. And they said, you know, we'd like you to interview for this editor position. And I tried to talk them out of hiring me. I said, I like to read magazines. Will you expect me to launch one? Insane. And I tried to talk, you know, the Sun-Times out of Splash. I said, that'll never work. And in this case, too, I was like, yeah, are you sure you want me for this role? I guess it must be, you know, I must have low self-esteem.
What have you learned about magazine? But even at the beginning of that, being like, what? I don't know anything about magazines. But now you do, because you have done Michigan Avenue Magazine. You've done Splash. You're now the editor and publisher of Chicago Magazine. What did you learn taking over at Michigan Avenue Magazine about magazine production?
I think the main thing is to focus on people. You know, one of the things people discount, you know, the whole Susanna's Night Out thing, and they think, oh, just a party girl. P.S. I fall asleep by about 10:15 every night. I'm the opposite of a party girl. I'm going to be falling asleep at the next commercial break. But what that job taught me is it introduced me to every power player in the city at a very young age. And it allowed me to have perspective on people and what they do and what makes them important and, you know, how they all contribute to the lifestyle we have. And it really is about people. If you want to engage readers, the stories that fascinate me the most are the ones about people.
Right.
And so, you know, when you have that institutional knowledge built on 15 years of kicking around a city and just encountering different people in different contexts and figuring out how they're connected to each other, that that I think is what makes me good at my job, because I really care about those people.
I mean, even
I care, you know,
even stories about people, you go further to relationships with people. I mean, the idea of getting to know the power players or even the people from your column, to be able to continue to follow them or understand their place in the city as you move forward.
It's something that's hard to do if you're an out-of-towner. You can't just plop into the city and really understand unless you've been really following it for a long time.
Magazines, I mean, 5 years ago we were having conversations about there won't be any more magazines. So we're going to sunset.
And a lot of them have gone under. Yeah.
Yeah, and we're going to be reading on tablets, and it's going to be something different. We've seen a lot of them go under, but we still see at the newsstands glossies like Chicago Magazine.
Sure.
What keeps them in production, in print production?
I mean, part of it is you hope to be kind of among the last ones standing. So as obviously, as advertising revenue continues to go down across the industry, as the weaker players fold, that does create more opportunities for the ones that survive. But I personally, I've always been a magazine junkie. At any given time, I subscribe to about a dozen at home, and every couple of years, I change up what I subscribe to because I want to, you know, see how another publication does it. And there's something about the magazine experience and looking at, you know, a luscious photo essay or reading a long form story that, you know, I don't know that a tablet experience really translates.
Right. I always feel that with like websites, because you hear that all the time, like magazines, you know, you could just go on a website and find it. But the way that a magazine is published or edited, in the way that it's a journey from page one to the end. I mean, there's something to that.
It can be an emotional,
yeah,
sensual, you know, an experience that's delivered to you as you go through the pages. So that's the goal that you want your publication to deliver. It's not always achievable.
Do you think that there's still an audience for that? Do people want that kind of experience from media?
Oh, definitely. There definitely is, because, you know, you see it in the circulation. There's still a very strong circulation trend. You see it in the web traffic. That people are still you get to see through your web traffic the sort of stories that people are actually responding to. Back in the day, it was all just done based on your gut.
Susanna Homan is the editor and publisher of Chicago Magazine, brand new job.
Yep.
Let's take a break and we'll get the news. When we come back, I want to talk about style, culture, and celebrity.
Sounds good.
I mean, it's an interesting town for it, right? I mean, that's I mean, you could be doing that in a different town, but you do it here. I just want to know what your thought is on the relationship here in Chicago to celebrity. We'll talk about it.
Sounds good.
Susanna Homan, my guest at the big table tonight. Stay with us. Hey, it's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Bobcat Goldthwait.
Nice.
How about that, huh?
How about that?
You're great. I'm looking forward to talking to him because, you know, he's made the rounds today and I paid attention to, and I listened. He was here on Bill and Wendy earlier today, and he's got a really interesting take on celebrity and the idea of being fulfilled.
Oh.
Yeah. It's like he's getting to a point and having to come to terms with what people know him for. Like, he really doesn't really like the fact that everyone knows him from Police Academy and that kind of stuff, you know, because he's
that
done
ship
so,
has sailed though,
right?
Hasn't it?
No, it hasn't. But that's what he was saying. Like, you know, it just hasn't. Like, people still are interested in him doing that character, and that's not who he is. So it's kind of interesting, and I'm looking forward to talking to him. So that's coming
cool.
up in the 9 o'clock hour here. Susanna Homan, my guest tonight here at the Download. She is the editor and publisher at Chicago Magazine. Just started. At that job.
2 weeks in.
We've talked about that job. We've talked about magazines. And the other part of it is celebrity. I mean, you did Susanna's Night Out, which was really a column, a nightlife column.
That's right.
From 2001 to 2008. And that's what you kind of did here. I mean, you chronicled the lives of celebrities and nightlife here in Chicago. How'd you get into that?
It was a funny assignment because the editor of the Sun-Times at the time, he basically said, so here's our idea. We're going to hand you a camera. You're going to take your own pictures, and you know, when you go out to these nightclubs every week, you're going to get in a picture with somebody, hopefully somebody famous. So you become part
like
of the party.
Early selfies,
exactly. And you know, and at first I was like, okay, that sounds like fun. But after about 6 months, I was like, I'm really sick of seeing myself, and I'm sure other people are too. So it eventually evolved, and I went out to all these things, and I met all these people. And And it was an education, you know. I don't think there was a party in Chicago that happened during that time, a grand opening, you know, a fundraiser that I didn't hit.
This is a party city. I mean, there's a lot going on. But it isn't New York and it isn't L.A. It has its own sort of style, its own celebrity culture. It's not the same thing as Page Six or what you see from TMZ out in, you know,
sure,
in front of the restaurant.
I mean, here it's primarily media and athletes, although now we get more and more actors with all these, you know, Chicago PDs and Chicago Med. And there are some more people like that kind of rolling around town, but not that many by comparison in New York or L.A.
Since you did that column, I mean, I mentioned TMZ. I mean, the world has changed in terms of how we view celebrity or cover celebrity. Now
sure,
you have TMZ and you have so many different blogs that every time a celebrity walks out a door, there are 40 pictures taken of this person. I mean, it's really like just, I mean, it's almost overkill, but it's a different than what you came up with. And even in 2001, there seems to be a change in the way that we cover celebrity.
Yeah, there certainly has. I mean, my approach back in the day, by the way, I think these people think I'm Paula Abdul because we're getting a lot of stares. And that's who everybody always thinks I am, right? They know, oh yeah. They're like, that's the editor and publisher of Chicago Magazine, for sure.
That's Susanna from Susanna's Night Out.
That's what they're saying. But, you know, when I was doing that, I approached it with a lot of kind of innocence because things didn't go viral in those days. And so I always figured I would write about what actually happened when I was out on the town. So, like, when R. Kelly balled up his phone number on a napkin and slipped it in my hand, I wrote about it, you know. And when Kanye West, he was, you know, he actually was really weird when I met him because he was afraid I was going to write on his shirt when I was taking notes. And he took my pen and showed me how I should hold it so that I wouldn't write on his shirt. You know, I had all these like funny, and I would just write about that. Like, you know, I was at this party and Kanye West thought I was going to write on his shirt. And it was a different time and much more innocent because you could do things without really thinking about, you know, thinking about it following you on the internet for the rest of your life.
Well, I mean, what was your relationship like with publicists and people like that who, you know, if Kanye West was acting erratic or you wrote about R. Kelly, did you get calls from people that were like, no,
I did sometimes, you know, there were people who were mad at me.
Cause that's a whole relationship that people don't know that most of these celebrities have publicists. They're trying to get into your column.
Yeah. The person who was, sadly angriest at me back in those days was John Cusack, actually, because I wrote about a fundraiser that he skipped. And, you know, yeah, people would occasionally, but usually the stuff that I was writing about was just not that. I mean, it was party coverage, so it wasn't anything that deep or difficult. So for the most part, you know, publicists were welcoming.
For you, I mean, it's evolved because Michigan Avenue Magazine was more style and culture. Splash is the same concept, style and culture, but it still has, you know, you're attracted to Splash because of the celebrity. You know, obviously a ton came out of Jenny McCarthy being able to do the guest columns and things like that.
I gotta say, I think Jenny McCarthy gets a bad rap. I've worked with a lot of writers. I've worked with a lot of people who've been published by national magazines in the New York Times. And I would put Jenny, I mean, you're going to get hate texts and emails for me saying this, but I would put Jenny up against nearly anyone because,
really? Yeah,
she is one of the hardest working people. And when I initially met with her, you know, she was supposed to do, we were doing these like occasional celebrity pieces and she said, no, I want a full-time job. I want to write 5 days a week. And I said, no, you don't. There's no way. I mean, professional writers can barely keep up a 5 day a week pace. You know, that's just not really something you want to do or commit to. And she said, no, I do. And she wrote some incredible blog pieces for Splash. We kept the stuff that she did in print pretty light. Most of her kind of heavier and more thoughtful stuff went online just because it didn't really fit the format in a, you know, small publication. And then she got the job in The View and then, you know, she became much busier. Yeah. So that ended. But, you know, she's a really hardworking, thoughtful and responsive person. And I can tell you, you know, if I email her right now, within 60 seconds, I'll get an email response. And if I ask her something, you know, she's about as professional as they come. So I have a lot of good things to say.
But
about
I mean,
her.
The idea of Jenny McCarthy doing the column or the other guest celebrities that have done stuff for Splash. I mean,
sure,
the idea was to take celebrity and put them into almost a content part of it as opposed to covering the celebrities. They became the content. I mean, that's a change.
You know,
that's a switch from what you were doing.
And it was a little bit of an experiment. And I won't say that every single celebrity who wrote those Daily Splash columns approached it with the same amount of depth or thoughtfulness. You know, it was across the board. Some people are great writers and some people are not. But the reason you have to test things like this, you know, Donnie Wahlberg, Jenny's husband, has been writing some recent pieces for Splash. And when he writes something, he tweets it out to a million people. She tweets it out to 2 million
Absolutely,
people. And
right.
you get more traffic on that piece than something, you know, that you could have spent 3 weeks researching. And you can't not acknowledge that as a publication fighting for survival and relevance, that this is the sort of stuff that a lot of people want to read. So, you know, it's a part of that fabric. It's not the entire thing, but it's a piece of it.
You know, you mentioned that the celebrity culture here in Chicago is pretty much, it's changed because actors come here now. You know, Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, Empire is here.
Yep.
But it always has been media and athletes. I mean, the Michael Jordans and the anchors on the 10 o'clock news.
Right.
Right out of but it's changed. I mean, you seeing, you know, with media coverage, you're seeing so many more, you know, media people, whether it's a columnist, whether it's a publisher, like we're talking about, are getting more coverage. For you, I mean, you've been on both sides of the media. I mean, you've been the person who's covered celebrity, but you're also the person who's kind of been in the celebrity. You're a celebrity, whether you like it or not.
Not really.
But you know, yeah. So does that help inform the coverage that you do, the idea that your personal life and other things have been in newspapers, have been there,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I think
does
it does.
Does that help you?
It certainly makes you empathetic because as easy it is to attack public people, you know, I've been the subject of attacks and mean comments and scrutiny. You know, when you're going through a divorce, the last thing you want to do is read about it. Just like anybody. So it does give you that perspective of the sensitivity for what people must be going through, because people are people and we all suffer pain and humiliation and whatever it may be. But also, I mean, being out there, the good thing about it is it gets you access, because you know who to call if you want to get the interview, and that person will take your call. So in many ways, it can be helpful.
Susanna Homan is the publisher and editor of Chicago Magazine, her new job, formerly of Splash, Michigan Avenue Magazine, Susanna's Night Out, the column. When we come back, let's talk about Chicago, because you stayed here. I mean, you could have gone to New York. You could be doing style and culture where they publish magazines. You could be in L.A. where, you know, the celebrity culture is you can make more money.
What
keeps you here? What keeps you in the Chicago area? Susanna
sure.
Homan, my guest tonight at the Big Table. Stay with us. A little Kanye West for you there.
Thank you.
Yeah. Susanna Homan, my guest tonight, The Big Table, publisher and editor, Chicago Magazine. Before that, Splash. Before that, Chicago Michigan Avenue Magazine. Before that, Susanna's Night Out. Yeah, I mean, you have a lot. I mean, you've had a lot of
quite a
experience.
Body of work, don't
no,
I?
But, I mean, it says a lot about, I mean, you have really climbed the ladder to Chicago Magazine. I mean, because Chicago Magazine is considered, you know, it's the jewel of the magazines here in Chicago.
It really is. And it's not something I take lightly at all. You know, it's one of the things I've really been trying to do is go through all the archives and go through old issues and remember the best moments, recent and old, you know, remember the best writers, you know, really learn the current staff and what they're most proud of, because many of them have won awards. You know, it's a lot to take in. And I think it's an important part of figuring out the future.
Because you've had this experience of moving into different places, starting some stuff from the ground, I mean, does it change your approach to starting a new job? I mean, you're not the kind of person, or maybe you are, I don't know, who walks in and is like, all right, everybody in here right now, this blue needs to turn green right now. Susanna's got a new plan. Like, how do you approach a new job like this?
I think it's an evolution. You know, as the editor, everyone has different things that they're interested in. So always, you know, there's going to be a point of view that I bring to it that'll be different from anybody else's point of view, because it's based on your opinions and your interests. But I don't believe in any jarring changes, because number one, it would be a bad business decision. There's an existing readership that is committed to what is currently happening. So you don't want to do anything that disrespects the readers or that feels too foreign to them. And so you make slow changes. You might decide, you know, instead of running this in the middle, I'm going to run it in the back. Or, you know, I might change the section title, or, you know, you might make like tiny changes as you go. And then eventually, you know, those things issue by issue start to create a framework.
So what's the short-term and long-term for Chicago Magazine? I mean, what you just said, I mean, is you sort of tweak little things. I mean, do you have – are you formulating a plan for what you think about 30, 60, 90, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, that kind of thing?
I am. And, you know, honestly, it involves a lot of stakeholders. So I've been doing one-on-ones with everybody who works there. And it's an enormous team. I've never worked anywhere that has – it's fun. People are taking pictures outside. Yeah. This is the craziest studio I've ever been in. And they think I'm Paula Abdul. I swear to
not.
You.
That's they think you're Susanna Homan.
All
go
right.
ahead.
So, but yeah, you know, they have about 40 people who work there, you know, between the editorial side and the sales side. They're in an enormous operation, much bigger than anything I'm used to. And step one has been sitting down with people as groups, but then one-on-one and just kind of understanding what are they all up against? What are the salespeople up against? What is the marketing person up against? What is the circulation person up against? What are the different editorial groups up against? Because they have things that they want to do that they, you know, for whatever reason, they may have challenges. So part of what I'm trying to figure out is, you know, what can I help make happen? But it takes time. I'm only 2 weeks in, and it would be, I think, premature for me to announce, you know, sweeping changes.
So you're not going to change the name?
Yeah, well, I'm going to call it Splish.
Splish. All right, Chicago, let's talk about the city.
Yes.
You went to Northwestern here. You have spent 15 years in Chicago media. Why? What about this town inspires you, and what about this town do you want to leave behind?
Oh, no, leave behind, nothing. I love it here. And, you know, something happens when you've spent your entire career in a city. And one of those things is that you kind of can't walk down the street without bumping into somebody you love. You know, so I live probably a mile from this studio, and I'm just active, and I go out and I see people. And, you know, when I go to other cities, it's just not the same. And any intersection that you could point to, I could tell you, you know, oh yeah, you know, I went on a first date with somebody at that bar, or, you know, I had some experience there. And that's something deep and special that you can't really recreate anywhere else. So I've never wanted to leave. I've never had any interest in leaving Chicago. I like to travel to refresh my brain, but there is nothing that would make me want to leave here.
Well, no New York City, no L.A. I mean, those are they seem to be more industry specific to the kind of industry that you're in. What about those towns?
Yeah, New York is definitely the center of publishing. And I've spent a lot of time in New York. My sister actually married someone from the East Coast, and she lives just outside of New York in Connecticut. And my parents moved there from – I grew up in Elmwood Park. So, I mean, that is like about a Chicago, right?
Right,
I mean,
right,
is there
right.
any more Chicago than Elmwood Park? But but they all live in Connecticut now, and I visit them, you know, every 3 months or so. And so I'm in New York a ton, and New York just doesn't have the magic for me that Chicago does. And it I don't think it ever will. So I've never even seriously looked at moving to New York. L.A., I mean, please. I don't have the money to live on the water, and I don't like all the strip malls. So I'm not an L.A. person. It's just not for me.
I mean, are you where you want to be? I mean, as a journalist, as someone who went to Northwestern, I mean, this is kind of a dream job.
Yeah, this is the show. Yeah, I would say that, you know, this is I didn't expect to be here. That's the thing. And I have a lot of respect for the people who are already there and who allow me to be in their presence. You know, I really want to honor what is already there and do whatever I can to try to make it something that everybody in the city wants to pick up every single time an issue comes out.
Susanna Homan is the editor and publisher at Chicago Magazine, recently at Splash, before that Michigan Avenue Magazine, before that Susanna's Night Out, before mm-hmm. that Northwestern, before that Elmwood Park, we go all the way back.
Before that Gottlieb Hospital in Melrose Park. Yeah.
She's my guest tonight at the big table. Thanks so much for coming in tonight.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My next guest tonight is playing shows this weekend at the Comedy Shrine in Aurora. He's one of the most prolific stand-up comedians and filmmakers of our time. It's hard to believe that Shakes the Clown is 25 years old and One Crazy Summer, 30. American classics. But past that, Bobcat Goldthwait has become one of the most prolific and adventurous filmmakers, making several films that have played to critical acclaim at Sundance and festivals worldwide. It's my pleasure to welcome Bobcat to The Download tonight. Bobcat, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks. I didn't realize Shakes was 25 years old.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah, 1991.
Yeah, Shakes can rent a rental car now legally without a an adult cocaine.
What do you what comes to mind when you think about that being 25? That movie being 25 years old.
That I'm old. I guess I just got tattooed last Saturday. Tom Kenny from Shakes, Binky the Clown, on my calf. Mostly, I got it to freak out Tom. I think he's a little weirded out that he's tattooed on my leg now.
It's interesting because you were on Bill and Wendy today on WGN Radio, and you told them that you make a living to make movies. That's what you do. Do you consider yourself a comedian, or do you consider yourself a filmmaker?
I think of myself as a comedian. I mean, I describe myself as a comedian. And then the making movies as a writer and director is like, I know I do it, but I know that that's not how most people perceive me. So I don't call myself a filmmaker, even though I've made 7 movies as a director. It's just because I know that's not how people know me. You know, most people usually think I'm dead, or if they don't think I'm dead, they only know me from movies that I did almost 30 years ago, which is fine. I shouldn't say that. It's kind of annoying. But, you know, that you can't change people's perception of you because that's just the reality. You know, I was on the local news this morning, and the first thing before we're on the air, they play a clip from Police Academy.
Right.
And that's what happens every Friday morning when I do local news, whatever city I'm in. And it hit me. I was like, wow, I was thinking of Gary Shandling. I was thinking, man, when I die, that's what they're going to do. They're going to play Police Academy clips.
Well, I mean, I think it says a lot about your career in the way that you were such a huge star in the 80s and the 90s, the movies that you put out, like I mentioned, One Crazy Summer, even Shakes the Clown, but the Police Academy movies. What's your relationship, I mean, if you can't have a relationship with your past? When you think back to that time, are you sort of proud of that work? Do you want that stuff to go away? Do you want people to think of you differently?
I don't want it to go away, and I'm glad for everything I've ever done because it ended up getting me to where I like being. I like making movies, and I'm happy I can do stand-up to keep me off of reality shows. But I don't look at those movies and think, boy, you really nailed it there, BC. You know, let's not put our foot through a Van Gogh. I would like to teach a class on showbiz. Like, even when I was doing those movies, I was like, man, this doesn't feel right at all. But everybody was like, including myself a little bit, you know, hey, they're asking you to be in a movie, you should be in it. Even though I'm like, well, I don't know, man, I'm gonna be talking about, you know, if I knew that I would be talking about Police Academy 28 years later, I would have worked harder on them.
Well, let me ask you, you know, I mean, you mentioned the reality show, but you've escaped sort of the trappings of Hollywood of like being on the network sitcom that's really not that great, or being on a reality show, or Dancing with the Stars, or whatever it is. You've bypassed that. You've gone to being a filmmaker, to putting out your own work, writing your own stuff. How did you escape those trappings? How did you make your way out of that?
Well, I just quit. You know, I think it's important. I think when you're going on reality shows, you're not thinking that it's an end to a means. Maybe you are, but I think a lot of them are, well, I'm going to do this show, and it's going to reinvent me, and I'm going to, you know. And I just said no. I just said no. I just quit. You know, I think it's important. It's very un-American to be pro-quitting, because we're always supposed to be like, never give up, you know. But, you know, that's where you keep quitting until you end up someplace you don't want to leave, and then you're happy, you know, and not happy in the sense the traditional American way. People kind of perceive, like, there's this whole thing that we're sold that we're supposed to be having an orgasm all day long, basically. Like, for the People's Republic of Spring Break. But being fulfilled, you know, that's a different thing to pursue, and I'm very fulfilled.
Well, let me ask you, you know, that the character, I mean, the character of Bobcat that everybody knew, the one that was in Police Academy, the character that we saw in all the HBO specials. I mean, that's not what we're hearing. That's not what we get from Bobcat in 2016. When you think,
no, I mean, I never really called that character. I was called Bobcat before I did that character. So I would vomit if I suddenly was watching a movie directed by Manny Pig. you know, a Bob Goldthwait joint or something.
Right, right.
So, I mean, I guess I don't take myself too serious, even though sometimes I can be a windbag now.
I guess the question I have is, what is your connection to that character? Do you feel like, you know, it's obviously been the character that people know as Bobcat,
yeah,
that voice and everything. Well, and now you take, I mean, you do stand-up as well. So what's your relationship to that character?
It's a little frustrating because back in the day I was doing that character. At the same time, I'd be doing Iran-Contra material. And but people aren't aware that I have material because they grew up watching Police Academy. So I get my place as a stand-up comedian is often minimized, but that's fine with me. I think it's weird. You never know what you're going to do that suddenly people are going to think you're good at your job. You know, I did this movie, Call Me Lucky, which is about my friend Barry Crimmins, who's a brilliant political satirist, but it's a lot of it's about him as an adult dealing with his child abuse, coming through the other side and ending up changing a lot of lives in the meantime. It's a very heavy movie. I just made that movie because I wanted to tell my friend's story. I didn't think this will be a good calling card in Hollywood. People will see that I'm a filmmaker, but that's the weirdest thing, that the least commercial movie I could possibly have made is the one that's gotten more focus and attention as a filmmaker. And the reality is that I only made it because I love my friend and I wanted to make a movie about him.
The one thing about that movie, about the movies you've made, they're movies that are interesting to you, and they're challenging. I mean, they're challenging material, they're challenging topics, they're challenging conflict involved in that. I mean, it's much more than the stuff that you were doing, even in your stand-up routine, or even, you know, in the movies we're talking about, Police Academy and in the 80s. Is that where you want to go? The material that you creatively pursue and write and get involved with, does it have to challenge you and push you and your limits as a creative person?
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, hopefully you're always trying to do stuff that you find interesting and not rest on your laurels or whatever people's preconceived notion of you is. But the reality of it is, you know, I'm 53 and I rent, so maybe people shouldn't really listen to me. You know, I'm out there on purpose. I keep my lifestyle very to a minimum. So I can say no to, I used to be famous, watching me eat crocodile nuts, whatever else they want to put me on.
I mean, you mentioned today on Instagram, you put up a tribute to Gary Shandling. And one of the things you said is that, you know, he realized at an early age he got involved in comedy or television. He realized it wasn't going to fill the void. And so he kind of broke the formula and had fun with it. But he realized it wasn't going to be the end-all, be-all to you know, being a Hollywood star was going to make his life happy. You know, can you relate to that?
Yeah, I think Gary definitely is a hero of mine. He started as a young man. He was writing on Sanford and Son.
Right.
So he's making all this money and working on a popular show, and I know he wasn't fulfilled. And, you know, eventually I know that that's what led to him creating these things that were, you know, he put the formula in the system and took down Hollywood all from the inside. But the one thing about Gary that isn't often seen or spoken is that he wasn't Larry Sanders and he wasn't Gary Shandling from It's the Gary Shandling Show. Gary was very profound. Spent a lot of time thinking about heavier questions in life and knew the importance of being a well-rounded person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, comedians and people in show business in general or in life, you know, the narcissism and the drive usually doesn't make for the most well-rounded people in the world. He was a pretty deep guy.
For you, you know, I'll ask you a question I ask a lot of different people who have been in Hollywood, and we just mentioned with Gary. What makes you happy? What makes Bobcat Goldthwait fulfilled?
I really get off on it when I get to sit in the theater and watch a movie that I wrote and directed, and it clicks with an audience and it connects with them. That's a great feeling. But what really makes me happy is usually like 2-3 nights a week, I'm sitting in my living room with my roommates and my daughter, and we're all just a bunch of idiots telling stories and talking about our day. And usually there's a lot of making fun of me and my love life. That seems to be the big funny.
That fulfills you.
Topic. Well, that isn't familiar, but the last, and I don't mind being comic fodder.
Bobcat Goldthwait is playing shows this weekend at the Comedy Shrine in Aurora. He's my guest tonight. Bobcat, thanks for taking some time out. Good luck with the shows.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for the kind words. Thank you so much.
It's Download here on WGN Radio. Justin Kaufman. Well, in less than a week, we got a little baseball. I would say the opening day is next Monday? Anyway, we got a week. You could tell tempers are flaring if you saw the Madison Bumgarner, Jason Hayward dust up over nothing. The miscommunication. You kind of can understand that these guys want to get at it. This, plus the fact that the Sweet 16 is at the United Center, means it's a perfect night for WGN Sports' Sam Penjanovic. Sam, good to see you.
Good to see you. I'm flipping through my 2016 Midwest Regional program. It's more than 60% ads. There's literally 40% content. Look, you got a full page with an ad, and then, there's a little bit of script on this page.
Style over substance, man. That's the Sweet 16. Okay, so you were just at the United Center.
Yes.
You got to see the first game, Northern Iowa.
No, that was Virginia and Iowa State.
Iowa State. I'm sorry about that.
The second Fred Hoiberg team that can't play defense.
Yeah, right. There it is.
Iowa State, they didn't guard anybody. Virginia had 84 points. I think at one point Iowa State was down... It's 12-2, and then it just—I mean, they clipped it to like 6 at one point, but they were never in control.
Well, let me ask you, because it seems like, you know, we talked about this was the year of the underdog. There are going to be more teams coming through, but once you get to this level, it pretty much evens out.
All number one seeds are still alive, and for all the talk about—I feel like every opening weekend we talk about, well, that was the best opening weekend ever, and look how much parity there is. Yet, when you advance it 1 week. You know, today, number one, Virginia rolls Iowa State. North Carolina up by 10 now on Indiana. Yesterday, Kansas rolled. Oregon rolled. So is there a lot of parity, or is it just early because there aren't a lot of really good teams? The cream does rise in every sport, but I think people are sort of taken off the path, and they think because they see an 11 beat a 6
right.
And then a 12 beats a 5, and then, Michigan State goes down. This is the best year ever, but...
It's not.
It evens out, and usually the best teams are still around, and right now you could have all four number ones in the Final Four.
I'm always curious about the behind the scenes at a Sweet 16 or at the United Center right now. I mean, is it packed there? I mean, is there a ton of people that are there to see Virginia and Iowa State or to see Syracuse and Gonzaga?
It depends on the schools, and that didn't really answer it the best way possible, but I think, like, Syracuse, they weren't supposed to be in the tournament, and... Their fan base is huge. It's all over the country, and Chicago is a great city to go to. So can you take, if you're a Syracuse alum, do you mind taking 3 days, go and hang out in Chicago,
right, watch
a little basketball, and, you know, hey, if the team loses, you're still in Chicago, and it's a nice tourist weekend. You know, I think depends on the teams, but they've got some pretty solid teams as far as fan base. Iowa State is a huge fan base. That place, there were more Iowa State fans than Virginia fans. And I think Cuse has the biggest fan base. But it's cyclical. It depends on who's there.
I went one time to a first round at the United Center. It was an interesting night because it was me. I was really young. I was maybe 20 years old. Me, my girlfriend, and my girlfriend's dad. First meeting, right? So I'd watch it. And that was a different kind of thing because it was every game, you know, quickly there was another game because it was a first round kind of thing. Do they clear the whole stadium between games, or does a Syracuse fan just sit through both games?
No, it just rolls over, and it's an event ticket, so you have the whole night. I think earlier in the tournament, there's more games, so I think it goes by sessions, if that makes sense. You either have the early session or the afternoon session. By here, it's just one session, and it's a double dip, so you get to go to both games. And it just sort of blends together. I think there were a lot of sections where maybe the Cuse fans weren't there yet because they're probably still at happy hour.
Right.
And rolling in. You know, that's a late tip, too. I mean, that game literally tipped 20 minutes ago. Those people are bombed in there. But it's fun. You know, I'm going to actually go back there after this because it's still – I mean, it's 9:30 at night and they're still in the first half.
It's amazing. I mean, they're only doing two games, and then on Sunday they'll have the one game that the winner goes to the Final Four.
Yeah, it looks like it'll be Virginia – maybe Gonzaga as Cuse cuts at the three. So, I mean, this night one is more of a coin flip. But at the end of the day, you still have the best team in the region playing in Chicago, and that's sort of a big deal.
So, I mean, no Big Ten left. I mean, this is it. Wisconsin still playing?
No, Indiana right
Indiana,
now
right.
against North Carolina.
But not a great showing. I mean, usually we expect the Big Ten to be in the Final Four or around the Final Four. There's always a surprise team. I think it was either last year or the year before. It seemed like it was all Big Ten. Not a great showing for the Big Ten.
The Big Ten's best team lost to Middle Tennessee State. That's the Big Ten's postseason. That's Michigan State, and they lost to a team that I don't even think you could name the mascot, could you? Just make something up.
The chorizos?
You can say Bulldogs and probably get it right. I believe it's the Blue Raiders of Middle Tennessee State.
Sam Finianovich is my guest tonight. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get to the news. When we come back, let's preview the Cubs and the Sox. I have some questions that are still unanswered. You were down in spring training, got a chance to see some of it. You know a little bit more than I do about these teams and can maybe answer some of the questions that are still out there. No one has talked about the fact that the Chicago Cubs, who are on, you know, this sort of mission from God to win the World Series, at the end of that run last year, they couldn't catch a ball in the outfield, right? Kyle Schwarber, I kind of chuckled a little bit when he's on the ground and the ball's getting by him. You're like, what's happening?
And there was the one picture of Soler's face down eating some grass, and the ball is on the warning track. You know, he's
and
face
that was
down.
A huge, and that plus the fact that these young guys, just like to swing at everything that was thrown at them, especially from the aces. There were still a lot of questions, and I want to know if those questions have been answered. Sam Pinjanovic, my guest tonight, will do more coming up here on The Download. Stay with us.
One ball, one strike, one out, one run. Ducky at the bat, and the kid's what he done. Hit the ball in the back, and the bat in the ball. You should have heard them fans all squall. It's going, this time it's really gone.
All right, we're talking baseball. We're previewing, we're sizing up the two squads here in Chicago, the Cubs and the White Sox, with WGN Radio Sports reporter Sam Pinjanovic. All right, Sam, so let's talk with the Cubs because, you know, as I mentioned before the break, there were a lot of – I mean, they had an unbelievable, magical season, and it can only go up with all the talent that's so young on this squad, and we did see some free agent pickups. But the Chicago Cubs had some serious question marks at the end of the season. One, left-handed ace pitchers. You see that they didn't do so well against those New York Mets starters.
Power arms.
The power arms.
Guys that came in and threw 95, 96, right. 97, dialed it up. The Cubs were striking out at record rates at points in that series.
And then the second part, the defense, where you saw a little bit more of the gambling that Joe Maddon did, where he put the bats in the lineup because that was good, and he put a catcher out in left field. And we saw kind of an embarrassing show towards the end of that series where they're making errors that you just don't see in baseball.
Yeah, and that's why they brought in some of the guys that they brought in. You know, they feel like they can shore this offensive lack of base runners by bringing in Jason Hayward, bringing in Ben Zobrist, and putting them, you know, in that lineup. And they're going to probably hit Hayward, I would imagine. It's either or maybe second or sixth, depending on where he slides in. And then actually Zobrist could hit second as well. You're going to have Fowler leading off. But when he doesn't play, Hayward could hit first. And they feel like those guys can get on base for the boomer bust guys. And, you know, a Chris Bryant three-run homer is a lot better than a solo homer. So that's the plan. They want guys that can get on base in front of the big boppers and eventually turn those runs in the postseason that, you know, they multiply as opposed to just being, because they had a lot of solo home runs last year in the playoffs. A lot against St. Louis, too. Baez had a two-run homer in the playoffs. But a lot of those solo digits on the scoreboard, they hope to improve by bounce.
Now, a lot of rookies. I mean, Chris Bryant, of course, rookie of the year. You had Kyle Schwarber. You had, Jorge Soler.
Well, last year they won the Cy Young. They won the Rookie of the Year and the Manager of the Year.
But the rookie class for the Chicago Cubs, including Javi Baez, what do we expect from them in year two in the majors?
Honestly, and this won't make a lot of people happy, and it sounds like I'm pessimistic, but the game humbles you really quick after that first season. And the best of the best are guys that can sort of avoid that sophomore slump. You know, the arrow is always going up and to the right. For most players that come in and have a little success in year one, historically, statistically, in year two, it tends to come back a little more. You know, balls are hit right at somebody, and maybe you strike out more and walk less. And then the really good players bounce back from that adjustment. It's like the pitchers react to what the hitter did in the year before, and then they're ready to attack with the scouting report. So I think Bryant might be okay. I think he'll have the best year, but I expect regression from Addison Russell at the plate, Schwarber, Baez, Soler.
That's a lot of names.
Yeah, I mean, it is. Now, you know, does that mean that they can't hit a baseball? No, but I think they're going to struggle early in the season, and then it gets to, you know, second half of the season, and you need those guys to bounce out of it in order to make the playoffs. That's pressure they didn't have really last year because they had so many wins and it was fresh and it was new. Now the bullseye is on their chest and it's a different game that way.
So the other question, you know, obviously they can be protected in the lineup with Jason Hayward. He's not a rookie. He's a veteran. You have Anthony Rizzo who now has moved himself into more MVP status.
The MVP.
So
next
maybe
year.
You may still see a Kyle Schwarber or Chris Bryant pitch to just for the idea that they don't want to touch a Rizzo. They don't want to touch a Hayward. So it could actually help them that they added some bats. Let's talk about the other side, the pitching staff for the Chicago Cubs. The rotation solidified with John Lackey. So now you got Jake Arrieta coming off a Cy Young season. John Lester, who's got a sore elbow, which is not an issue till it is. My favorite quote of the week last week. It's not an issue till it is.
Yeah, until it's a problem, it's not a problem.
Then you've got John Lackey. Then what? I mean, are the Cubs, what are the Cubs doing in the back end of that rotation?
Well, think of it this way, because in the postseason, it was only Arrieta. Everybody else was sort of off the mark. And you would rather have guys that can win you games in the postseason. You know, I don't care that Kyle Hendricks might be the fourth or fifth starter. In the playoffs, their plan, Theo and Jed, their plan is to throw these three guys at you in a playoff series. Arrieta, Lester, Lackey. You play maybe a six-game series, those guys are throwing five times. That's what's going to matter. It's not going to matter who your fourth and fifth guys really are in the postseason. That's the plan. Look at it more top-heavy than anything else. The other guys in the regular season just have to log innings. Just, you know, give six innings a game, get through the season healthy, and then the big horses will carry you. John Lackey has a World Series ring. John Lester, I believe, has two. And they think they have the best pitcher in the National League in Jake Arrieta. So that's the plan there.
Okay, my next question is about injuries. Every team has them every year. They're going to have guys that go on the DL, you have pitchers who have sore arms, that kind of stuff. Are the Cubs equipped to handle injuries?
In the lineup, yes. They have enough depth. They have enough utility guys that can come in and play multiple positions. Ben Zobrist can pretty much play anywhere on the diamond. They're sort of grooming Javi Baez in that same light, and they hope that he can actually learn a lot from Zobrist. But if a guy goes down, if Russell goes down, they can put Baez at short. You know, if Zobrist goes down, they can put Baez at second. There's so many things. The guys you can't afford to lose, I think, is the best way to answer this. Can't afford to lose Anthony Rizzo. Can't afford to lose Jake Arrieta. Can't afford to lose John Lester.
Mm.
Those are the three guys that have to be healthy in order for you to make the postseason. I'm not even talking about win the World Series.
But you know, it's a long season, and just from someone who's an avid fantasy baseball player, none of these pitchers go a full season anymore without a 15-day stint. I mean, it just seems like that's the way baseball is moving, that injuries are becoming more and more a part of it, especially for throwing, you know, for pitchers. I mean, Tommy John went from, oh, that's interesting, we should give that a name, to every pitcher has to do it as a rite of passage. So, I mean, there is a possibility you're going to see at some point or another a Lester, a Lackey, an Arrieta get on the shelf.
And I think Lackey's 37 now. So, I mean, that arm's been throwing a lot of innings for a long time. John Lester is 32, so he's still got some good solid years left in his prime. Maybe not even in his prime anymore, maybe the back part of the career. But the guy that had the meteoric rise is always the one that gets pressure to the moon. And for Jake Arrieta, we just kind of talked about this before he got on the air.
A lot of innings.
What can he do that isn't, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, how does he improve on what he did last season?
It was an amazing season.
In the eyes of the fans, because he won 22 games, his ERA was 1.77, four complete games, three shutouts. He was the Cy Young in the National League. And I think in the second half, his ERA was sub-1.
Well, I think that Jake Arrieta, I mean, I don't think that fans have the expectations that you're going to see that again. But to fashion a career like Adam Wainwright or Roy Halladay, was a good example where he didn't always have an under 2, but one season he did, and then maybe at a 220, maybe at a 3. But the point was, is he kept you in games. He was a gamer, which we saw Jake Arrieta was, And that's that was the sort of wild card scenario where it just it was more than just, you know, what his ERA.
You're right. He's a completely different guy. He's confident as ever, but it's not arrogant. It's just it's a self-confidence, and that he can go out there and he can do the job. But when you look at his early numbers in Baltimore, his first couple of years, ERA his first year was 4.66. The next year it was 5.05. The third year it was 6.20, and then he was sent down to the minors. So the fact that he's come in with the Cubs, gotten better 3 years in a row, and has entered his – now he's going to be 30 this year. He's entered the prime of his career, and there's no looking back, I don't think. The only thing that's going to slow him down is an injury.
Last question, wild card in this scenario for this team, Joe Maddon?
I think you'd love to have Joe Maddon in any clubhouse in the game.
So fun.
See, somebody had this debate with me. How many extra wins is he worth? And he said he's worth 20 extra wins. I don't know if you can really put a number on it. Well, he said if he move Russell to short and put Schwarber in the outfield and hit him second or whatever. I said you can't quantify it. I don't know how many he's worth, but I know he wins you way more than he loses you. And that's what I'll say about Joe Maddon. Plus, he keeps all the players fresh and kind of shaking up the lineup day in and day out and always having guys ready. That goes in the bullpen and in the rotation. When you're sharp at work in any profession and it's your turn to come up and deliver, you're ready and you're prepared, and I think that comes from the whole mindset of what Joe Maddon does
with
the clubhouse.
Sam Pinjanovic, WGN Sports. Let's take a break. We come back. We go to the south side, the Chicago White Sox. Are they still talking about Adam LaRoche? Are they still doing that?
Did you see the Iowa State fan? He had his thumb up, and then he turned his thumb down. Iowa State fans walking by.
The Iowa State fans here on Michigan Avenue tonight. Sam Pinjanovic in studio. Stay with us.
Let's go, 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 White Sox. Chicago's proud of you.
So download here on WGN Radio. We're doing season previews for Major League Baseball, which starts, I believe, April 3rd. Opening day is April 4th. Sam Pinjanovic, WGN Sports, with us. Talked a lot about the Cubs and their World Series run. Let's talk about the Chicago White Sox.
I thought you were going to say their World Series run like you knew something.
They, you know, the White Sox early on, USA Today, before the Adam LaRoche stuff, had the White Sox, you know, with a chance to win the division and possibly contend for you know, an AL pennant. So the White Sox, on paper, people like what they did.
If this makes any sense, and you can try and correct me if I start getting crazy here, I feel like the White Sox the last 4 years could have been in first or in last in the division, and I wouldn't have been surprised.
Right.
Because you have the pitching with Sale and Quintana, and Rodon is awesome, the lefty out of North Carolina State that they got a couple years ago in the draft. I think he went third, and they took Schwarber fourth on the north side. So Rodon was a guy that I know Theo and Jed would have loved to have drafted. That being said, the offense has to do something, anything.
Well, that was the big storyline for the Chicago White Sox was that last year's free agents haul, they brought in everybody from Melky Cabrera to Adam LaRoche to others who came in and said, we're going to bring in some bats. They failed. They were the worst home run team in the majors and the AL. They were the terrible run producers. They didn't put any offense up. What did they do to get better?
Well, they got a lot younger. I mean, they got rid of Alexi Ramirez. Adam LaRoche has since retired. You know, they brought in Todd Frazier, who they feel can be a big bat for them at third base.
All-star from the Reds.
They feel like that's a guy that can hit 35, 40 home runs in that short porch. Well, in Chicago.
Maybe in the porch. Yeah,
A lot of home runs now. I mean, the Sox last season had 30 from Abreu, and then nobody else had more than 15. Frazier is a guy that makes everybody in that lineup better because, you know, his insertion just, it makes the lineup more dangerous. Then you can't pitch around Abreu because last season it's like, all right, we'll just throw Abreu five fastballs near the outside corner, and if he doesn't hit one, we know we're going to get the next six guys out, you know, because
surprising to me, there's been a lot made of Avisail Garcia.
Right, and Brett Laurie, too, who they brought in, who had a really good year.
He hasn't come, I mean, he had an injury the year before, and there was, like, concern, but they said, oh, this guy's going to be a monster for the White Sox. He didn't really pan out. His numbers last year were very disappointing. This year, it doesn't look like he's having a great spring. He kind of got lucky in the sense that Adam LaRoche retired because they slot him in a DH, bring Austin Jackson into the outfield. But that there's too many of those stories on the White Sox like lineup, the idea of these disappointing players.
I asked the question, I think it was last week. I said, when was the last time the White Sox had three outfielders that were homegrown? and I couldn't. I went back to like 04 when it was Rowand, Lee, and Ordonez. Mm-hmm. That's the last time that they had three guys that they actually drafted and developed and all started in the outfield at the same time. So it's been that way. You know, when was the last time the Sox brought in a third baseman that could play every day?
Well, they got one now, right?
Drafted and developed, drafted, yeah. I'm talking.
Well, they're not. They don't seem to be doing that with anybody.
Joe Creedy? I mean, that's 2003.
Name one player on that squad, I mean, on the field, that is a homegrown project. Laurie's at second base.
No.
Abreu's Cuba. Third is Frazier and the Reds. Saladino, maybe? I mean, is he
Saladino was, is, but yeah, it's going to be Rollins. Jimmy Rollins is short. Rollins. So the fact
Eaton's in center. You got Garcia came from the Tigers. And in left field is
Melky Cabrera?
Yeah, there's nobody.
So, okay, that tells you everything that you need to know about player development. You know, they can develop pitchers. Their pitchers have been solid. I mean, they've gotten innings out of, you know, like John Garland. I know they didn't draft him, but they turned John Garland into a 20-win pitcher. And Mark Burley was a guy who they developed.
And they're doing it with Carlos Rodon and Chris Sale, obviously.
Jose Quintana, who was a send-off from the Yankees that they got in. Don Cooper is one of the most underrated pitching coaches in the game. He loves it on the south side, and he's not going anywhere. But you need some of these guys to have better years. The thing is, though, we talked about with the Cubs in regression from really good years to maybe average years. I think on the south side of town, you're going to have guys that had awful years sort of regress back toward the middle.
Melky Cabrera.
I mean, Adam Eaton, you know, he had 14 homers, but he hit, you know, 287 as a leadoff hitter. Garcia had 257, Cabrera 273. You know, Tyler Flowers isn't here anymore. You brought in a couple catchers that can hit the ball in Navarro and Avila. You know, you got rid of Trace Thompson, but you feel like you got better with that trade.
Well, let's talk about the defense for that team, because I remember last year, and there were some times where it's just a lot of walks. They walk Carlos Rodon, who's a tremendous talent, was averaging 5 or 6 walks a game. At
no,
a certain point.
Not that
he
high.
Was.
No
man,
way.
I went to the cell and I watched a game where I'm like, I can't believe he's walked 6 guys in this game.
He led the team in walks with 71.
Yeah, I mean, so you hope that he, you know, is ready to play. Like he's ready to go. But on the defensive side of the ball, they did get better.
I think so, and that starts with Austin Jackson, like you said. He is probably the best defensive outfielder they have, so when you have a good center fielder, it makes left and right a lot better because the range doesn't have to be as high. They can play closer to the lines, and Jackson's a guy who's going to get to a lot of balls both over his shoulder, behind him, and then in front of him as well. He's got a good first step. He's extremely quick, so that's good in the outfield. And then up the middle, you know, they feel like they've got guys with Jimmy Rollins and Brett Laurie who are going to be – you know, one of the top 5 double play combos in the league. You know, Alexi Ramirez was good for so many years, but last year he had some off-the-field stuff. There was a lot going on in his personal life, and I think it sort of changed the way that he prepared every day. I don't think he was on his game. I think Rollins is going to be a good defender, and then Abreu at first, not so sure. Not so sure how good he is defensively, but he can hit you 30 homers.
Same question applies on injuries. Are the White Sox equipped to handle some trips to the DL?
No. Next question. No, they just can't. They need guys to have – they need like 4 or 5 guys to have career years for them to make it to the playoffs. I'm not saying that that's not possible, but you need a career year from a guy like Carlos Rodon. You need one, you know, from a guy like Chris Sale. You're going to need one from a guy like Jose Abreu, from Todd Frazier, and maybe one more guy. That's what it's going to take. Uphill battle, absolutely. But when you think 2005, you know, 04, they lost Ordonez, they lost Carlos Lee, and Frank Thomas was hurt pretty much all of 05, and they won the World Series. Yeah. So with that combination of players having career years, anything's possible.
Okay, so the wild card for the White Sox, are they going to get over this Adam LaRoche business? They have to,
I don't know. The kid was such a good leader. He's 14 years old, and he lost a true leader. Are you kidding me with that? And I'm a Sox fan, okay? Like, I grew up on the South Side. When I heard that, I literally spit my root beer everywhere.
Adam Eaton said that,
I was like, what are you
we
talking about?
We lost a leader
about?
In Drake.
A leader of what, the circus? That clubhouse was a joke last year. It was so embarrassing, and you know, you go in there after
how
the
so?
Game.
How so? What do you mean? Like,
they just, you know, losing didn't affect them in really a negative way. You know, they were just kind of like, yeah, you know, whatever. You know, the only guy that was really upset was Chris Sale. Every time he lost, he was ticked. But hey, I don't think losing affected them last year.
Justin, can I ask a quick question? Yeah. Do you mind? Sam, what do you think of Reinsdorf's response to all of the nonsense at spring training? I mean, he came out, he was pretty forceful in what he said to these guys.
He was, and I think that's just him putting his foot down. If you want to go ahead and try and talk again, you know you're gone. That's what that is, Rob. And, you know, there is a lot of respect around this country for Jerry Reinsdorf as an owner and being loyal and, you know, sort of protecting the shield, if you will, protecting the logo. And he's done that with the Bulls. He's done that with the White Sox. That was him putting his foot down and saying, all right, nobody else says a word, and if you do, you have to deal with me. That's what that was to me. And you notice nobody said a peep since we got the email from the White Sox chairman.
If the Chicago White Sox start slow, we talked to Rick Hahn about this, if they start slow, which they have for the last couple years, and they fall 8 games back, 10 games back, Robin Ventura.
You have to make a move. And that's not because I don't like Robin. I think Robin's a really good guy. He keeps the guys fresh. And they do like Robin Ventura as a guy. But results do speak for themselves. And they've been in one postseason push since he's been here. And they collapsed in 2012.
I love that that's a thing, a postseason push.
They haven't been in the
postseason.
No, I mean, they haven't even
been. Now there's a postseason push.
They haven't even. Well, that's how I have to shape it from the South side. I mean, yeah, we were kind of close until April, and then we were done. You got to get close, and you got to be in contention. Otherwise, it's time to make a change.
Do you use Lamaze for that postseason push for these guys?
That's good.
I mean, come on.
Sammy Penjanovic, WGN Sports. Thanks for breaking down the upcoming season for baseball. Now get back to the UC.
Good luck on the text line.
If you're on your mark, this is how we'll start. Frying pan hot, frying pan hot. If you want the sizzle, even just a little bit, simple as a tickle. Not too much, too
big. Wow. Pete Zimmerman outdoing himself. Wow. A new theme tonight here for the frying pan. Well, it's time to put Shark Tank Steve Gadlin into the frying pan. Yeah, well. Gadlin's the brains behind the successful local business I Want to Draw a Cat for You. He presented his business idea on the television program Shark Tank, and he snagged Mark Cuban as a principal investor. So now Steve has to go back to Cuban with new ideas. And before he goes into that pressure cooker, he comes to WGN Radio to jump into the frying pan. There we go. He's giving us his exclusive business idea so we can poke holes into it and give Steve the confidence to pitch to Cuban at a later date. Steve Gadlin, welcome back to the frying pan.
I'm so excited to be back.
Good
Justin,
to see you. You've been gone. You were in Europe for a little bit.
I was.
Spiritual journey?
Well, you know what I did is I traveled the world, and I came back a new person. And I've got whole new levels of ideas brimming around in my head that are they're worldly ideas, and I hope they're not above the heads of some of your more local listeners. But I'm going to give them a shot.
All right, there we go. So you know the premise here. Steve's going to give us his idea, and then we're going to accept your criticism, critiques, I don't want to just make it negative, your positive thoughts, your A-OKs. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, 312-981-7200. Steve Gadlin, what's tonight's frying pan idea?
Okay, so let me tell you, while I was spending time in Europe, or Europe, as we called it.
The locals.
Yeah,
okay.
That's what we called it. You know, I noticed one thing about Europe that's different from America, where I'm from, is the food is strange. It's a different kind of food, and it's not, you know, it takes a while for your palate to get used to it. So another thing I noticed was that a lot of people were wearing scarves out in Europe.
Okay.
So what I wanted to do was I've created a special pocket that goes in a scarf that actually is it generates heat that you can keep hot dogs in. So you wear the scarf and there are hot dogs in there. And then when you go out to a special European restaurant and are offered strange foods that may not suit your less sophisticated palate or they just might look strange and feel strange to you, you can discreetly pull the hot dogs out of the warming pocket and have hot dogs, take bites of the hot dogs just to keep your hunger at bay. a very European solution. And again, I don't have a name for it yet. I was hoping your callers could help me with that too this week.
Okay, so a hot dog scarf.
Well, yes, basically.
That's what the working title is going to be for me right now, hot dog scarf.
Okay.
Okay, I've got questions.
Yeah.
312-981-7200, but as I always say, this is not a segment for me to do the questions. This is for the listener, the Download Nation. 312-981-7200. What do we think of the hot dog scarf?
Yeah, and I'll say too, Justin, it's not just a scarf with hot dogs in it. Okay, that's not an invention. That's just a craft. This is a scarf with a special warming pocket that discreetly hides hot dogs. So you can. This is the great thing about it. You can walk out of the house and put a hot dog from the freezer in the pocket. By the time you're sitting down at dinner and presented with something you're not really comfortable with, that hot dog will be ready to eat, warm and ready to eat. And there's a lot of technology behind this where it's actually using your body's movement and natural thermal energy to help with that heating. So it's not battery powered. There are no wires. It's not something you have to recharge. It's pretty impressive technology that goes behind this.
All right. Well, we'll take a break. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. You can text or you can call to give your opinion, yay or nay, on the hot dog scarf. Steve Gadlin's in studio. It's the frying pan. Stay with us.
On your mark, this is how we'll start. Frying pan hot. Frying pan hot.
Oh, that's great. That's a good new theme song here for the frying pan.
I like that one. That's
the Download. Steve Gadlin is in studio with me, local inventor. I want to draw a cat for you. He won on Shark Tank. Now he has a development deal with Mark Cuban, and he brings his new ideas to the Download first so we can workshop them tonight. The idea is unnamed, but right now the working title is Hot Dog Scarf.
And, I think we really need a title as sophisticated as the concept here, so I'm not sure that one's going to fly with me. You know, really, it's... I don't know if your listeners have ever been to Europe before, but sometimes you're faced with foods that just make you uncomfortable. They put things out in front of you on the tables that are just really strange. And what you want is a discreet way to sneak a hot dog.
Mm-hmm.
So again, this is a scarf, which is very fashionable in Europe, very fashionable. You put on a scarf, it has a built-in pocket that will warm a hot dog from frozen to ready to eat. So you can really... scarf your scarf, if you get what I'm saying there.
Well, this is a special frying pan because you don't have a name for it, so
right.
You're asking for callers and for texters to come up with a name as well.
Yeah.
They are responding. Let's go to the lines. Let's go to Tim. Tim, yay or nay on the hot dog scarf?
What do you guys think of the weenie warmer?
Ah, the weenie warmer. I like that.
That's interesting. But again, I think that's a very American title. And that's, I know you've got a lot of American listeners who may not be as worldly as I am from having been to Europe. So I don't know if the weenie warmer really hits that sophisticated.
Tim, do you like the idea of the invention, the scarf?
It's not something I would go out and buy, but, hey, I've never been to Europe, so I don't know.
There you go. All right. Thanks, Tim. There you go.
I was there just the other week, so.
Tim says, I guess I would put Tim down as a yay because, mm-hmm. He understands that the foods might be bad. Let's keep going. Let's go to Mason. Mason, yay or nay on the hot dog scarf?
Yeah, we're out here camping right now. We got some fish in the frying pan.
Great.
But anyway, we said nay. I mean, even if you're going out for some fancy pants European dinner, I mean, who's going to carry around a hot dog? What if it smells like hot dog?
Yeah. That's a great question, yeah. They do have a smell.
Someone asking you why you smell like hot dogs. Like,
no, that's a very good question. And actually, the scarf itself is coated in a very pungent perfume to cover up the what I would call a positive stench of baking hot dog. But, I understand some people don't like that. So there is a musk that's emitted from the scarf that covers that up. That's very fashionable. It's a very European scent.
So a cologne of some sort.
Yeah, a musky cologne.
Okay, let's keep going on the phones. Let's go to Glenn. Glenn, yay or nay on the hot dog scarf?
I think it's a big yay. I
Oh, yay! All right,
thanks. Great.
I never thought that he could really improve himself on all the fine ideas that he has. And this right. one, above all, tops them all.
There you go.
And I think a good name would be Scarf One Down.
Scarf One Down. There you go, Glenn. That's a good one. I love that.
Glenn, you have
thank you, Glenn.
I thought for the other side, seeing that you can't use hot dog buns, maybe if you use like flatbread on the other side of it, that you can just wrap the hot dog in the
like a bagel dog or something. Yeah. Thanks, Glenn.
Yeah. You know, I want to clear something up though. This isn't a hot dog that you're going to take out and then put in a bun and then mm-hmm. eat in front of people. The way it's designed is you put your chin down to your chest. And it will squirt out a little piece of hot dog. You can just sort of chew it off of your scarf very discreetly so that you give the deal is you give the appearance of this sort of fine, fancy European dining, but you're secretly taking bites from your freshly warmed hot dog.
Hmm. Okay, 312-981-7200. That's the number, 312-981-7200. Got a lot of texts. Let's stay on the line real quick. Let's go to Susan. Susan, yay or nay on the hot dog scarf?
Nay. Maybe. I have a name for it.
Okay, what do you got?
Just in case. Encase.
I like it. Encased meats. Yeah, that's good.
That's clever.
Would you buy a just in case?
I'm not a big hot dog eater. But,
well, how do you feel about fancy European food stuff?
Good.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Have you seen them, though? Have you been to Europe?
No, but I think it might be a good idea for little kids to carry a little snack in there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think people would look at kids strangely if they're wearing this level of stuff.
No, I think she means that there'd be a snack that the parent can wear and then have the snack in the pocket.
Well, but you can't remove it you have to put your chin down to your chest, and then a little piece pops out so you can nibble it off your scarf. So it'd actually be impossible to remove the hot dog and then hand it to someone else. It's all about discretion here, and discretion is a big thing in Europe, too. They, you know, you don't want to come across as a brass, loud cowboy American. They don't like that image out there. You want to play like you're eating the schnitzels or the mm-hmm. escargots or whatever the funny foods are that they have, but you're secretly eating the hot dog.
Let's go to some of the texts here as more phones or callers queue up. I see queue instead of lineup.
Oh,
for
good.
Europe.
Familiar.
8773's got a good one. Nay. Because what if I got attacked by a dog because I smell like hot dogs?
Well, again, it's the musk, I promise, would keep any animals at bay, the musk this emits.
Okay.
So it's a non-edible scent that comes out. It's nothing you want to be near.
Okay. 847 says, why don't you name it the doggy collar?
Interesting. I think that it conveys a lot of imagery that wouldn't, you know, it's not hitting my target audience. Again, I'm looking for the globetrotter, you know, the worldly fellow like myself, because last week I went to Europe. And, you know, that's, I don't know that would speak to that audience.
630 says, he just returned from his little trip to a country called Europe. I think he meant it's not a country, but why not just carry a PB&J? Nay.
Well, again, a PB&J is not discreet. Mm-hmm. PB&J is a little, there's no way to hide that. This provides a way to secretly snack on a freshly warmed hot dog.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Patrick, yay or nay on the hot dog scarf?
I'm going to give it a nay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I was kind of wondering, two parts. Number one, I was wondering what the invention that he got Mark Cuban's attention in the first place was. And
Okay. Second,
I was kind of wondering if this was kind of a joke, because wearing a hot dog and a scarf seems a little ridiculous.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, this one is a little far-fetched.
Well, Patrick, I'll tell you know, riding around on a machine with four wheels faster than humans can move seemed ridiculous before it became what we now call the car. So, yeah, I wouldn't call this ridiculous without, you know, it's something that hasn't reached critical mass, but once it does, it'll, you know, sneaking a bite of a hot dog from your scarf will be as normal as zipping around on your scooter. So The invention that I got Mark Cuban's attention with was a company I have called I Want to Draw a Cat for You, where I draw stick figure cats for people. And you can see it's real and it exists at iwantodrawacatforyou.com. So now I'm expanding my worldview and dipping into the Globetrotter market to find some cool inventions for people who travel.
All right, let's do one more call before we take a break. Let's go to Susan. Susan, yay or nay on hot dog scarf?
I think it's a good idea. I like the name of the weenie warmer. But although I lived in Chicago for at least 20 years, I happen to like ketchup on my hot dogs. And we used to get the very best hot dogs in the world at Golda's Hot Dogs, right across from Loyola University Medical Center up there years and years ago, where you could get real natural casing hot dogs. But, you know, anybody who likes ketchup on their hot dogs, I guess I'm not really a Chicago gal.
But, yeah, right. There's definitely discrimination against people who put ketchup on their hot dogs.
Well, yeah, there is. And in Europe, the discrimination is a little different. It's they don't mind if you put ketchup on your hot dogs, but you don't put mustard on your snails. That's a joke. I was in Europe last week.
We know. 312-981-7200. That's the phone number. We're going to get to text and we'll get to the calls and people are waiting. Wayne, I want you to stay on the line if you can, because I think that's great, your comment that's coming up here. It's the frying pan, the hot dog scarf. That's the invention tonight for the frying pan. Stay with us.
If you're on your mark, this is how we'll start. Frying pan hot, frying pan hot. If you want the sizzle, even just a little bit, simple as a tickle, not too much, too quick.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. It's Frying Pan. Steve Gadlin in studio. 312-981-7200. We got a brand new invention tonight. Yay or nay? That's what we want from you, Download Nation. Steve Gadlin, of course, from Shark Tank. He has his business, iwantodrawacatforyou.com. Now has a development deal with Mark Cuban. Before he brings ideas to Cuban, he brings them here to the download, to Frying Pan. Tonight's idea, the hot dog scarf.
Well, it's not actually called the hot dog scarf. I was hoping to have a little more sophisticated title, but it is a scarf that you would wear in a place like a sophisticated place like Europe, where I spent some time last week. And it has a built-in warmer pocket so that you can take a hot dog from frozen, slide it in your scarf, and when you're out to dinner and they slide some fancy European uncomfortableness in front of you, you can push your chin down to your chest and discreetly snack on the hot dog to still sate your hunger without having to eat something you're uncomfortable with.
Okay, 312-981-7200. 630 wants to know, will it work with pre-cooked strips of beef, chicken, or bacon?
That's a great question, and it can. So there's, you know, it's special non-electronic warming that uses the thermal energy from your body to warm the food. So if you are using something that's pre-cooked, it may get a little tough, and that would be hard to, you'd be kind of gnawing at your, neck area, and it wouldn't be as discreet as a nice, soft, plump hot dog.
Okay. Let's go to the lines. 312-981-7200. Thanks so much for holding. Frank, yay or nay to the hot dog scarf?
Yes, hi guys. I give it a yay.
All right.
I have a long beard, and it's an awesome beard. I've been growing it for a long time, and I would think that combination of the beard into the scarf, you know, I could just, you know, pull the hot dog up through the scarf and eat it, and I actually have a great name for your product.
Okay, what do you got?
It would be called the scarf.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. I love it.
Interesting.
Thanks, Frank.
You know, I will take that one step further, and to make it extra European, how about less scarf?
There you go. 312-981-7200. Let's go to Wayne. Wayne, you've been holding for a while. Yay or nay on the hot dog scarf?
You know what? I'm going to give it a yay.
Oh, thanks, Wayne.
That's great.
But I'm going to tell you one thing.
It would not work in Europe. And there's a reason why. I used to live in Europe. And one of the things, if you're there for some time, that you discover is in the middle of the night when you're coming out of the bars and you're looking around for something to eat, they don't have a lot of 24-hour restaurants. They have these people that you can find. Some of them sell shrimp salad sandwiches.
Right.
And there's always these guys on the corners that have these hot dog stands.
Ah.
And what you do is you can buy these hot dogs, except they are as long as the day, and they put them on these tiny little buns.
I see. Well, Wayne, so how long ago were you in Europe, though?
Oh, probably the last time I was there was around 1999.
Well, I actually visited last week.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but I was there off and on. I lived there for almost off and on for about 6 years.
Well, I was there for about, you know, I spent
3 or 4 days. Fantastic, by the way.
Well, that's the thing. You know, I think for a lot of American sensibilities, some of the food's a little uncomfortable. So if you have that hot dog hidden in the scarf, that gives you an easy and discreet out.
But you see, what I'm thinking is that you have maybe a good idea, but you're taking it in the wrong direction.
Well, I don't
know.
This is
the kind of thing. This is the kind of thing that I could see, just like you have if you're going to a Bears game,
mm-hmm.
and you're sticking that thing in your pocket to warm yourself up and to put it in your shoes and to warm it up.
Right.
Put a hot dog or whatever in your scarf and take it to the ball game.
Well, I don't know how many ball games there are in Europe, though.
No, I'm not worried about Europe. We live here. This is where your product is going to be sold. And so you got to find a way in which you're going to interest people with it.
I just think me having been there for a few days last week, I have a more modern take on the needs and wants of the people in that country.
Well, you might, but I still say that 6 years will trump that. And I hate to say Trump, but it's one of those things where you're very close to something that is a really palatable idea. And I think, you know,
well, Wayne, we're going to have to agree to disagree here.
Wayne, thank you so much for calling.
I do have a name for it.
What do you got? What's the name?
Okay, how about Dog and Duds?
Dog and Duds, I like that. Yeah, that's,
again,
Duds
I think that may speak to the Europe of the 80s, but I don't know if that's going to speak to the Europeans that I met with when I was there last week.
773 says, if I'm all dressed up, I'm not about to put something around my neck with food in it. When you put the scarf on and walk out the door, every dog in the neighborhood will follow you because you smell like hot dogs. Big nay.
Well, again, to reiterate, it also emits a very strong musk that will cover up the scent of the baking hot dog.
Okay.
So I don't think dogs or people will want to be anywhere near you, to be honest.
773 says, this isn't a new idea. When my parents were young, way back when, they would put baked potatoes or hard-boiled eggs in their pockets to keep their hands warm on the way to school, then eat them for lunch.
Well, that's disgusting. I think that's disgusting. I think your parents were hobos. And this is a different idea. That was using warm food to keep warm and then coincidentally eating it later. This is a way to discreetly bake a hot dog so that when confronted with foods in Europe that you may not be used to, you have an out. You have a discreet way of snacking on a hot dog to sate that hunger.
708 says, the hot dog scarf is something that I have needed forever without ever knowing it.
Well, there you go.
So there you go. There you go. Okay, let's try Alan here. Alan, yay or nay on the hot dog scarf?
Hi. Well, I wasn't actually calling about the hot dog scarf.
Oh, okay.
I had an idea for a sister product for it.
Ah.
I had the opportunity to be on Steve's TV show last year as a guest, and it's called Steve Gadlin's Talent, Star Maker,
rather. Right, Star Makers, yeah.
And my talent was folding pocket squares.
Ah, yes. Hello, Alan.
Hi, Steve. So the suggestion I have is, can you come up with an additional version with a little mini weenie that would fit in a pocket square so that the well-dressed man can also enjoy your product?
Oh, yeah, a scarf. Thank you a lot. Thank you for calling in, Alan.
In Europe, there are a lot of very well-dressed people, so that's actually something I had thought of, was a smaller pocket square version with cocktail weenies that would warm using similar geothermal body technology. And Yeah, so that's a great idea. It's one that I had earlier, and I thank you for chiming in.
773 has a good question that I thought about, too. You said the musk from the cologne. Does the odor rub off on the hot dog? Wouldn't that give it a funny taste?
No, so the odor is concentrated in the fabric of the scarf, not in the geothermal body heating pocket.
Okay.
So they're separate mechanisms.
They're separate, okay. Yeah.
One is just to mask the smell of the other.
Okay, 630 says there's better ideas than a scarf. Just don't buy nasty food.
Well, I wouldn't call it nasty food. I'm talking about food that, as an American, you may not be prepared for. Now, in the time I spent in Europe, I, of course, developed a sophisticated palate and was able to try some of these foods. But for someone who's just there on a day trip or visiting a friend or a relative, I'd say this is very useful then.
Okay, and the last thing I'm looking at right here, 630 says, constantly putting your chin down only makes you look like a bad inspector from the old bad movies.
Huh.
It's not discreet. And then 262 says, where are you getting these hot dogs in Europe?
Well, you get them from your freezer. You might want to bring them with you if you're planning a flight.
Mm-hmm.
But they go from frozen right into that geothermal body heating pocket and are ready to eat in about 2 or 3 hours. So you get them where you get them.
Okay, Steve Gadlin, the idea is called Hot Dog Scarf. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll read some of the texts that are a little bit more colorful response to the Hot Dog Scarf, as we do traditionally here on The Frying Pan. Stay with us. It's The Download.
If you're on your mark, this is how we'll start. Frying pan hot, frying pan hot.
It's a download, frying pan night. Friday night, Steve Gadlin is here. We're talking about his latest invention, hot dog scarf. This is a scarf for when you're in Europe and you don't like the fancy food. You have the ability to have a hot dog hidden in this scarf and you discreetly can eat it.
That's quite an elevator pitch, Justin.
Thank you.
Put you on my team.
You know, I do my best.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, so let's go through some of the more colorful responses to text. This is always a little bit more challenging because it's a little bit more pointed.
I have to brace myself for this.
All right, so let's go through this. 630 says, why don't we call it botulism bonnet?
Okay.
Oh, that's 219. That's good.
Okay. Well, I'll say there have been no scientifically confirmed cases of botulism in the beta testing of this product.
606 says, I got a name for it. It's called Not Gonna Happen.
Okay. Okay.
262 says, hot dog scarf? This guy's got no talent. If Portillo's or Superdogs haven't invented it, then there's no market for it.
Well, I'll say again.
Sorry, there was an idiot on the back.
I caught it.
All right,
I caught it.
All right.
Hot dog scarf makes this sound like it. I don't even like using that as a temporary name because it makes it sound like an unsophisticated product. Whereas the sheer utility of this in strange countries when presented with food you're uncomfortable with is this is for the sophisticated globetrotter.
Okay. 219 says this idea may be the biggest waste of time ever. And frankly, he's never had a good idea.
Okay. Well, but I don't know if this caller or the texter remembers how Mark Cuban invested in my stick figure and company.
So. 606 says, oh, brother.
Okay.
I don't know if that has to do with, I'm not sure what that is.
Maybe my sister was texting in.
It's possible. Let's see. 724 says, Steve is a genius. Trump should pick him for vice president.
Well, I don't want to align myself politically with any candidate, but I appreciate the genius comment. That's a good word.
630 said, it's very sad that listeners are calling in saying this is his best idea yet. It's terrible.
Okay. Well, what's one person sad is one person's happy.
Right.
So.
This guy is lame, 563.
Okay. What is 563? Is that even in?
It's an area code. 630, he bragged about going to a country called Europe. Give me a break.
Well, I was there just last week, a few days.
773 says he's so in love with Europe.
You know, for those of us who've had the opportunity to spend some time there, let me tell you, it's infectious.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful, worldly country. Rolling hills, very pastoral. I do love Europe.
Oh, this is Patrick. I guess he He's angry. 678 Patrick.
Okay.
Called earlier about this topic. Thanks for hanging up on me. I don't feel like we hung up on anybody tonight.
Yeah.
Just wanted to let you know that I'm a proud American who has traveled the globe.
Great.
The idea that we would rather eat a hot dog in a scarf than try scary new fun food is indeed absurd. This is not a worldly idea. I know a lot of people who would only eat hot dogs at restaurants. They're called children.
Well, I tell you, from one globetrotter to another, I agree with you. You know, those of us who've had the opportunity to spend some time in these foreign countries, like Europe, as I call it, we know that some of these foods can be marvelous. But I'm talking, this is a product for the beginning traveler, the American who may be afraid of some of those special new foods that get put in front of them, like, risotto or spaghettini, you know, some of those funny sounding foods.
773 says that this invention sounds disturbing because he keeps mentioning Europe. Okay, we get it. You've been to Europe. Stop mentioning. 847 says,
I was there just last week.
Huge nay. What's wrong with food in Europe? I've never found any place when traveling, especially in Europe, that doesn't have food I can enjoy. How picky are you, dude? People eat uncomfortable food, too. That's it. 773 says, nay, pathetic. 309 says, is Steve the dad from the Rugrats?
No.
I don't know what that is.
No, I've never. I don't. It's been a while.
847 says, why do you waste your time having this guy on? He got lucky with his cat idea. He's very rude and not in a good way.
Well, I'd like to know what rude in a good way means. And if I'm, you know.
312 says he can't think that visiting a few countries on a continent, they capitalized continent, makes him an expert on the people and their ways.
Listen, if this person is incontinent, I would not recommend.
No.
The...
Yeah. Well, not, that's not what they meant, but the, yeah.
But just as it's a good reminder, if you experience incontinence, this is not the product for you.
Right. That's not what a continent, meaning Europe is a continent, not a country.
Well, no, the people in Europe were quite in control of their bowels.
All right.
So the people that I had a chance to experience.
No, I think you're missing. 630 says this is a really dumb idea.
Okay.
630 also says it's the worst idea ever.
I think you're just rereading.
No, these are all 630s. Okay. This is one of the more entertaining and stupid ideas he's ever had.
Okay.
That's a good one.
Entertaining is good. You know,
nasty remark about hobos, 815.
Okay.
No, your scarf and schnitzel doesn't leave me happy. Far from puking, that's what it is.
Oh, like farfugugan?
Yeah.
That's good. That's good. Maybe there's a good pun there somewhere.
Let's see. Has anyone ever... I'm just about to the end here as we're running out of time. Mm-hmm. This guy's a wiener himself. That's 331.
They could have meant
773 says if he's so in love with Europe, then maybe he and Donald Trump can go there. This is not a sophisticated idea. It's tacky, 630. Oh, 312 wants to know if it's Bluetooth compatible.
Yes, I forgot to mention this is Bluetooth compatible. It does connect to your phone and gives you a text alert when the hot dog is ready to eat.
Okay, great.
606
says don't quit your day job.
Okay, I won't.
And then the final comment tonight is from 630. It says, I have a perfect name, Real Effin' Stupid.
Okay. Okay.
And they didn't use effing, they swore.
I don't know the...
Which is pretty... I mean...
Yeah, I'm missing the pun. I don't know if they're making a pun.
No, they're just swearing at you.
Okay. Okay. Well.
All right, there you go. The hot dog scarf. You know, I have to say that I was impressed with all the yays, Steve. There were 5 to 10 yays here. I'd probably say about 75 to 80 nays. But not bad in the ratio. I mean, I guess in the history of the frying pan... Much more, I guess, you know, you're getting some coverage. That's good.
Yeah, but I tell you, if the closest to a winner I've come is a fancy scarf you wear that preheats a hot dog for you, then I don't know how, I can't, you know, I don't know if this is pride or what. I think your audience isn't ready for some of the sophisticated ideas I may be bringing back from my trip to Europe, so I may... Scale it back down. Look deep down into my Chicago roots and find an idea.
It's probably
really
a smart idea.
Listeners here. Yeah.
We won't be on next week because there's a Blackhawks game next week.
Okay.
But the week after, Steve Gadlin will return with another episode of The Frying Pan. Steve, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
That's going to do it tonight for The Download. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Easter. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. We're back on Monday night. Chef Andrew Zimmerman from Sepia, who's also a nominee for the James Beard Awards, this coming up here in May. And also Paul Rust, the actor, writer, performer, musician, who is the man who is not only the co-creator but the main star of the show Love on Netflix. And he's also the co-writer of the new Pee-wee Herman movie, Pee-wee's Big Holiday. So that's coming up on Monday.